and welcome to episode 295 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, a place where a small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, writer of MI666, and joining me are the creator of the webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
The long-distance cowboy that is Tony Esmond.
You're right.
And, Tony, you're very well behaved this week.
Yeah, fuck all that. That'll be going. That'll be changed in any minute now.
Don't you remember all the shit that was said before we went on air?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's
terrible true. Stuff.
That stuff we can never show.
Disgusting.
But thankfully, our guest this week put up with it. And yes, we're joined by...
I enjoyed it.
Yes, this week we're joined by the writer of the comic series Hocus Pocus and the upcoming book, the creators of Batman, Bob, Bill and the Dark Knight, Rick Worth. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, Rick.
Now, if you recognise Rick's voice, I briefly spoke to him and Jordan Culver on the Thought Bubble special.
Yeah.
So hopefully you've already read the Hocus Pocus and the work that he's done. But with the news of his upcoming book...
Which I've started reading because I got a copy through today. Thank you, Rick. Yeah, it's really
very,
good.
Very yeah, cheers, Rick.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I've been reading the bit about wartime today. I've been really enjoying that bit.
Oh, yeah, that was quite fun to write. We'll talk about it. We'll get into it.
See, I mean, already we're excited to talk about sort of an area of comics that we haven't really discussed yet. But do you know what we discuss every week, guys?
Is it Comic House?
It's Comic House, our lovely sponsor. Yeah.
Smooth.
Yes, they are our sponsor. They are an indie comic marketplace with a difference. We love them. They support the UK and worldwide indie scene. And if you go to comichouse.com, there's a huge selection of titles on the database. If you self-publish, you can list your book on there, and it's another avenue to start selling your books straight away. But each and every week, we shout about what they have on their app. Yes, they have an amazing app that you can download for free. Just start a Comic House subscription. And then you get access to an enormous library of indie comics, such as, Dan.
We've got Glass City, The Story of a Missing Girl, Volume 1. The Glass Wall, which is put out by completely different creators. This has got a very similar name. And we've got The Tenth Muse, Issues 1 to 11.
Oh, you were saying that's landed. So that's an image book, isn't it? You were saying?
It is an image book, yeah. So you can read up to 1 to 11. That was released around, I think, it's a couple of years ago, but it's got very much the feel of a 90s comic. Yeah. Oh, it's even got the Savage Dragon in it, in issue 5.
Oh, nice. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, good stuff.
Yes.
So love Savage Dragon.
There's all of that and more. Yeah, we've talked about Savage Dragon quite a lot. There's all that and more on Comic House. So if you want to find out and read some of these comics that we talk about every week, just go to comichouse.com. There's a 14-day free trial, and it's only £3 a month to get access to all those comics and more. They don't disappear. The library is being added to all of the time, and it's an enormous library of amazing work. So, and plus, you know, if you're a creator and you've just got some PDFs hanging around, just pop them on the Comic House. They'll make you a few.
I'm very tempted to put Bingo Bonanza on there, but I think I might get cancelled.
Well, me and Dan will be completely upset because we haven't even seen that yet.
I showed you it on the webcam the other day. Gave you a little saucy peek, didn't I?
That was something else.
Rick, this is a comic I made in the late 90s. Do you know when you look back on some of your older work and you think, oh, fucking hell, that's terrible? I keep hinting about it, yeah.
I mean, if it's anywhere half as bad as what you were saying before we started recording, yeah, you'll be cancelled within moments.
I think it's just already happened and nobody's even seen it. Just preemptive cancelling because they know it's going
to
be awful.
The universe has had to cancel it before people can see it.
Yeah. Everyone should mark the calendar. It was episode 295, which was the last time we saw Tony Esmond. Or heard Tony Esmond. Oh, dear. But no, from comics getting cancelled to comics history. This week, we're taking a moment to... We thought we'd take a moment to discuss some sort of comics and comic-related work that sort of not only entertains, but informs as well. This show and knowledge, who'd have thought it? But sometimes it happens. But whether it's comics about historical events, people or places... The medium can offer so much to sort of help people learn about things that interest them and like just discover more. It's always fantastic when you put down a book or a comic and just think, fucking hell, I've learned so much from that. I didn't know that existed. Now, we've talked about a few prose books in the past that cover comics history from like Pat Mills, 2000 AD, to the history of Marvel and such. And I know there's many out there like us who love taking a peek behind the curtain and the history. I know Tony has, you've probably got about 3 or 4 books that you're ready to read at the moment, aren't you? You've got,
oh mate, yeah, I've got so many. I mean, I've got 3 shelves here just of history of comics. I just love it. I think it's such a rich,
yeah,
a rich thing full of real characters, and that does come across in your book, Rick, I've got to say.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Mort Weisinger is literally the sort of my biggest anti-hero of the world.
Yeah.
He's a fucking crazy genius in a way.
And all
he's got like a real... hang on, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yes, please do.
Man. Yeah, he comes off as like a real arsehole.
Yeah.
But he's like kind of like evil genius. Like the way he, in particular, tortured Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Yeah.
Because he knew that they would get upset and then put that into Superman and make Superman vulnerable. And he was like, yeah, it makes a better Superman stories if I if I actually just torture the creators. You're like, man, I mean, it works, but...
We told the famous story about him that I think is repeated in, I'm going to say, Slugfest, that book, where when he died, you know, people are at the funeral, people were would come forward and say good things about you, you know, the sort of Jewish funeral they had. And no one said anything. And it was like dead quiet. And then someone said, I heard his brother is worse. That's the only good thing.
But he's like one of these like revolutionary characters as well that you don't kind of realize that he was kind of there at the birth of fanzines as well, like him and the Superman guys. They were like writing little zines of short stories and posting them out, and he was like right there, like at the first underground comic convention. Mm. So
were they called like the Scienceers or something? They were like sci-fi fanzines or something. I think I've read in your book today.
Yeah,
really interesting, man. Yeah, I love all those people, and they were just guys. They put a shirt and tie on, and they go in the office and they do their job. And
it was a time when sometimes the characters were louder and social media, most importantly, didn't exist or anything like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, like we're talking about Rick's new book, which is one such book that talks about historical comics and the creators behind it, and is going to be especially interesting to all you Bat fans out there. So I only learned this recently. I mean, I don't know how many times you've posted about it, Rick, in the work. It was when you posted up the release, because the book isn't out yet. It's coming out in April.
Yep.
So to kick us off, tell us about like the creators of Batman and actually what led you to writing something like this.
So I mean the easiest explanation of why I wrote it was for money. I am ashamed.
You'll be a millionaire.
But basically I was doing quite a lot of journalism, and I was doing bits of like comic-y pop culture stuff, and then a kind of a small publisher said, oh, would you be interested in writing a book about the creators of Batman? And I was like, oh, yes, I would. I hadn't previously thought about it, because I kind of everyone kind of knows Bob Kane. And then about 2006, I reckon, people started to become more and more aware of Bill Finger.
There was a bit of a campaign, wasn't there, to get his name out there more, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah, definitely, like kind of back in like the kind of cultural sphere. So I was like, yeah, because I like you guys, like I really love comics history, and I was like, oh yeah, I've always kind of wanted to write about this. And then kind of as I was researching it, kind of what the trend has been, everyone loves Bob Kane, and then everyone started to hate Bob Kane, then everyone started to love Bill Finger, and now it's kind of like Bob Kane is a villain. And
yeah, really is. That's the rhetoric. That's the narrative at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And like Bill Finger is because Bob Kane is the villain, his victim must be Bill Finger.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not quite as clear.
It's more multifaceted than that. I think any fool knows that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And I think your book definitely does bring that out, man. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I think you kind of want to be fair. You don't want. I think part of me as well, because I feel like people who read comics kind of naturally have an inclination into just kind of assume the opposite of what they're being told. My kind of assumption was suddenly like, well, if everyone thinks Bill Finger's great, then he must have been a shit. There must have been shitty things about him. And if everyone thinks Bob Kane's a villain, he must have had some good side. And I think to be interesting, you've got to kind of bring those sides out to kind of compare them. I mean, the great thing about them is they kind of stand in for like a really good metaphor for like the entire comics industry about, you know, like whether it's better to be corporate or creative, like whether, you know, having the industry contacts like makes you better. I mean, it certainly makes you probably more successful. I think people in the small press would realize that. Or like, you know, whether just hitting deadlines and being productive is like the true sign of a creator. So yeah, hopefully like kind of that is all in the in a kind of Batman with Batman flavoring.
I think the thing for Kane as well, man, is like you say, it's a comic business. People often forget that, don't they? And he was very much business headed. I notice in your book you talk a bit about this legendary, but spoke about in hushed terms, contract that he had as well. You know, so he made a lot of money out of Batman, especially in those early days, didn't he?
Yeah, like one of the things Stan Lee said about him was that, like, of all the creators, he kind of admired Bob Kane as one of the most, because he was the only creator that owned part of the character. Like, none of the guys at Marvel. Right. So, not like, Stan Lee didn't own Spider-Man, you know, Joe Simon didn't own Captain America. They were all owned by the company. Whereas Batman, it seems at some point, either at the creation or, you know, at one point, they basically DC, like, get wind that Bob Kane is basically running this secret studio that's, like, full of artists and full of writers that, you know, he's just signing his name off on the work.
Yeah.
So DC is like, well, we better hire all these freelancers in, like, bring them into the fold so we can control the property and make sure nothing illegal is happening, which they don't do very successfully. But at that point, I think it's so hard for me to remember because, like, after reading the book like six times, I was like, I have to stop rereading this book. and that was like a couple of months ago. And then obviously pandemics just turned my brain off. But yeah, he like renegotiates his contract by saying, oh, when I created Batman, I was only 15. And they're like, what?
Yeah. And there was they're trying to work out actually how old he is. Because you actually went to the same school as Stan Lee. And who was the other person who went to the same school as him?
Will Eisner.
Will Eisner. That's right. Yeah.
Alvin Schwartz went as well. There's quite a few ended up there, but like different years. Bill Finger went, obviously.
Yeah.
Like that school, DeWitt Clinton High School, in like I think it's in the Bronx, just like turned out so many people who like contributed to the culture.
Incredible, isn't it? I know there's a famous story of Stan Lee. I think he tells it in a documentary where he says he used to go for lunch or dinner with Bob Kane, and he had to stop Bob Kane telling all the waitresses that he's the one who created Batman or something.
Yeah.
If Stan Lee is telling you to calm down on that, you're in trouble, aren't you? Yes. You know what I mean?
I touch on that on the book. Like, even Stan Lee was embarrassed about how much Bob Kane would sell himself, which is the other kind of story that I recount in the book is that Stan Lee would get annoyed that Bob Kane would inevitably show up late to their dinners. And he was like, who is this guy like to keep standing, you know, being late for dinners? So one day, the Lees, Stan Lee and his wife Joan, decide that they'll show up 30 minutes late to teach Bob Kane and his wife a lesson. And then when they get to the restaurant, Kane and his wife only show up 45 minutes late. So he's still.
That annoys me. I hate that. Yeah. The research must have been quite different.
Each other, isn't it? Like, I mean, I didn't know. Like, all the same high school. I mean, that's
incredible. Yeah, I think people who create some of the best characters that remain the best characters. Yeah, yeah.
I think Stan Lee was a few years behind Bob Kane, and then Bob Kane was in the same class as Will Eisner, but there's a bit of like dispute as to whether Kane was held back a year. There's a few rumors. I don't go too much into it in the book because I couldn't really get a handle on it to prove it's true. But a few people have said that they suspected that he might have had some learning difficulties, which isn't, you know, implausible. But I couldn't, you know, like without, you know, there was a psychiatry to someone diagnose him.
Yeah,
and I think like you know they all ended up at this school because that's where second generation Jewish immigrants, they all lived in the Bronx. If they were a little bit bright, they could get into this school, or, you know, if they knew the right people, they could get into this school. So inevitably, like, the birth of comics, like, revolves around this one high school in New York.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Incredible.
Mind-blowing. Yeah.
That's the thing about the research, though, as well, is, Rick, is, I mean, if you think about it, I think Bob Kane's daughter is 72. Never mind Bob Kane. You know, so this... I mean, God bless Stan for lasting so long. But how did you go about researching something that is, you know, pretty much a century old almost?
Oh man, well it was so difficult because with Finger, like hardly anything was known about him, and you know I have to give massive respect to a guy called Mark Nobleman who made a documentary called Batman and Bill, and he's a guy in America. And he runs a website called Noble Mania, and he did loads and loads of research into Bill Finger. And I basically got in contact with him and was like, do you mind me, you know, referencing you and using some of your research. Because obviously, like, you know, I'm in Leeds, I can't just phone someone up and be like, hey, are you related to Bob Kane? Tell me what happened to him.
Yeah.
And then with, you know, obviously with Kane, like you said, like his family is ancient, like can't get in touch with them. So it was kind of like a lot of trawling through old copies of the like comics journal and like trying to find obscure books. And there was lots of like internet trawling where I'd see things where, you know, it'd have like a quote by Kane and someone would like attribute to some bizarre book that was out of print. So I ended up having to buy like loads of...
Yeah, I was going to say it must have been a lot of eBay action because not everything's online anymore, is it? You know, you do have to actually go and buy stuff. Yeah.
Like, one of the most bizarre books I had to buy was a book called Fads, Fallacies and the American Culture, which is by some journalist that just like follows, you know, like crazy things that people suddenly were interested in. Batman's in there. And a lot of the... That's the other thing about Kane. A lot of what he said publicly was basically from rote, like it was the same stories over and over again.
Okay, yeah.
But then in this one book, he gave an interview about what he thought about Batman the TV series, Batman 66, about what he thought about gay people liking it. So he comes out with this quite homophobic quote, and you're like, oh, Christ. Crap. Like, you know, part of it you can put down to it being, you know, the 60s. And then another part of it you can put down to it being... Well, that's still quite homophobic, you know, like whether or not it was different back then.
Yeah, we asked Bob Gay, what do you think of Batman? And he says, well, the gays like it. You know, dear me. Yeah.
He says something like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're all sat around watching it and slapping their thighs. And you're like, oh, come on, Bob. Jesus.
Jesus Christ.
Wasn't there some incident with him and Starenko in a lift or something? Is that right?
Yeah, you've mentioned this, Tony.
Yeah.
Yeah, that like again, this is one of the stories that I felt I had to put in there because I managed to actually get through to Steranko and say, I use some of your quotes from Steranko's history of comics? And yeah, it's kind of some, obviously the way Steranko tells it is amazingly funny, but he says that Bob Kane comes up to him and like smacks him on the face and is like, what does he say? It's like, hey, Jim, baby, like that, and just gives him a slap on the face.
Right.
And then the elevator doors close, and Jim Strangle's like, I don't really understand what just happened. But then he says that he goes home, and he's like thinking about it all night, and the words are going over in his head, like, Jim, how dare you call me Jim, baby? And then he says, like in the middle of the night, he goes out to find Bob Kane. He's like, I'm going to go find Bob Kane. he finds Kane at this restaurant with, like, Kane's got all these hangers on. And he slaps him and he calls him like, you know, take that, Bobby baby. And then he calls him like bat bitch or something. But the thing is like when I kind of had a little tiny bit of correspondence with Steranko, he was like, yeah, you can use this quote from the book. But he was like, just so you know, he was like, you know, I respect Bob Kane and I respect Bill Finger for two very different reasons. I mean, I don't think he liked Bob Kane, but I think that was kind of... And I think it's that business savvy he did kind of respect. The other thing that he misses out in the story, and I had to do a bit of math to, like, work it out. When the story takes place, Steranko was probably, like, 28. It looked like Steranko used to be, like, an escape artist and was, like,
like a genuine character, isn't he?
A gangster. Yeah, like, he was in peak physical form. And Bob Kane... Like a lot of people don't know this, he could barely turn his right hand all the way around because he had an accident when he was a kid. And in that story, he's in his 50s. So what you have is an old Jewish man like slapping the other one in the face in a kind of like, hey, we're kind of
like a Dean Martin-y kind of way, or something, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And then a young man getting annoyed and finding an elderly man in the middle of the night and slapping him. And when you put the story that way, it becomes like, oh, that's. Maybe not as hilarious as it's originally
done. I did get the sense a little bit, especially with him and Neil Adams, that the stories just became more and more exaggerated with Steranko and Neil Adams.
Once I was trying, I pitched an article. I can't remember where it was, but it had something to do with Steranko, and the editor just said, "No, I'm not publishing anything about Steranko." And I was like, "Why not?" And he's like, "You just cannot prove any of the shit he comes out with. Like, you know, he claims we've invented the go-go girl." You know, she reminds me of that bit in Austin Powers when Dr. Evil says that his father claimed to have invented the exclamation.
Or we invented post-it notes or something. Exactly. That. Yeah.
It's like an unprovable fact.
Yeah, there's definitely a certain aura around Mr. Steranko, and not least of all his very obvious Irish that he wears. Yeah.
I think it totally speaks to the worth of this book, though, it's not just a case of like, oh, here's that story, I'm just going to put that in, because some people take these things, a book where you could literally just search the internet and probably copy and paste lots of things into a manuscript, but you're doing the diligence of talking to people, asking for permissions, you're trying to get the, I mean,
showing references, you've got to show the footnotes, haven't you? Yeah, that's the thing.
It's journalism. Yeah. I mean, although you said it's for money, but it's also it's journalism you're doing at the same time,
well,
isn't it?
Well, you kind of, you know, you don't want to be sued. You don't want to defame anyone.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, this is me being like, look how cultured I am. I once heard Christopher Hitchens say that, like, a journal, any biography of anyone shouldn't be like, I think this, or perhaps this happened. It shouldn't ask questions about the psychology of the people. It should just present the facts. But then I thought, well, we don't know much about Bob Kane because his public persona, his personal personas were. You know, one was hidden, like he was old school style, like he wanted to be Bob Kane famous, but then if he closed the doors, he didn't understand why people should be interested in his life. Like he kind of, when people would ask him, like, you know, we heard that you didn't pencil this page, he was like, why are people so concerned about the creative process? Why aren't they just fans of me, Bob Kane?
Okay, interesting. And firstly, mate, I'd just like to say me and Dan are huge Hitchens fans, so
nicely done.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. I'm just trying to, you know.
Not so much his brother, but Christopher's Christopher's a sad loss. But yeah, no, it's nice. I mean, did you study journalism? Is that how you got into this sort of thing?
No. Well, I actually studied philosophy and theology, which is probably where I picked up my Hitchens. It was around that, you know, period when Hitchens
Dawkins
was doing,
and
like,
all those guys. Yeah.
And I could never quite become like one of the new atheists, because I thought, oh, some of you are just nubs. Like, yeah, Christopher Hitchens is very, very charming. Richard Dawkins is not charming.
Although he is married to Lala Ward, so he did something right at some point in his life. Married to Romana.
It's kind of, you know, I was trying to write comics, and then, you know, that doesn't pay very well. And it's just because I was, you know, wanted to write so much, and I was very opinionated. And then over the last, since about 2016, I started doing work online and then working for a few places. So I kind of stumbled into journalism in a very, like, roundabout way. But yeah, that's just how you get there. And then I think the thing with the book is sometimes I worry that because Kane and Finger, you know, there's not a wealth of information that you can freely get about. It's not like Stan Lee where there's like five books or, you know, more about him.
Yeah.
A lot of it I had to kind of be like, okay, so let's have a look at what was happening in the world of comics at this time and see how I think this is going to have, you know, how it would have affected them. So, I mean, I before I started research, I didn't know about the DC writers purge in the 70s, where the writers were trying to unionize and be like, you know, we want some creators' rights, we want healthcare, we want a better page rate. Like, all perfectly reasonable things to ask for. They couldn't get the artists to get on board with them because the artists were getting paid much better money and didn't want to rock the boat. So then DC just froze out all the Golden Age writers. Right. So someone like Bill Finger would have been a part of that freeze out. Like, then suddenly, and he had money troubles all the time anyway. So suddenly it would have been like, what's he thinking now? Like,
well, the Superman guys came and worked in the UK, didn't they, for a while? I mean, if you look at a lot of the British Weekly stuff, that was done by them.
Yeah. I mean, have you guys read Secret Identity? The
Fingeroff book. Is that Fingeroff?
I think it might be Fingeroff. It's, you know what, annoyingly, it's on the shelf behind me, but I can't turn around.
Yeah, mine's locked and I can't see it. Yeah.
Joe Shuster started like doing like kind of Tijuana Bible kind of like, smoke comics.
Yeah.
He's saying, you know, this guy, by all rights, should be a millionaire, and he's, you know, not there's anything wrong with drawing, you know, pornography.
Well, that's another thing, isn't it? It's Neil Adams who kind of brought that up, isn't it? Going back to Neil again, but he's the one who fought for Siegel and Shuster's rights around the Superman money, didn't he?
Yeah, and along with Jerry Robinson. Like, Jerry Robinson gets quite a lot of mentions in this book because basically, as I was reading it, I was like, oh, you can't really say that those two guys created Batman on their own. If it goes in like three stages, it's like Bob Kane has an idea, Bill Finger refines it, then Jerry Robinson like brings it up to level, like he really skills everybody up.
And I guess you're saying Dick Sprang would be the fourth one, would you?
Oh, or... yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, basically by the time Sprang shows up, if I'm not misremembering my own book, basically it's like the Sprang and Finger show.
Yeah.
And Sprang, because like Sprang's, you know, I wouldn't say more cartoony, but like a lot brighter style. Like he makes Gotham less gothic. It's more of a ridiculous place.
Yeah.
That allows Finger to be like, oh yeah, I'll have a 25-foot typewriter. And, you know, that could be a perfectly, you know.
What became the Silver Age, wasn't it, really?
When yeah, you look at it that like, way. Yeah. Yeah, leading right into kind of Carmine,
Infantino, yeah.
Yes,
Infantino,
sorry, yeah. Kind of taking over from there. Like he takes one of the Bat family books and it's kind of split duties. But really, Bob Kane's not doing anything since about the 50s, so it doesn't really matter anywhere. Yes, yeah, it's
love Carmine. Story. Carmine's fucking brilliant. I had a conversation with Carmine where he couldn't understand me and I couldn't understand him because he was so New York.
Yeah.
And, it was the best. And then he drew me a picture of the Flash in my hand and I said goodbye. But yeah, at least I got to meet him. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a very similar encounter with Marv Wolfman.
Ah, cool.
Do you know Tony Lee, the kind of British comic writer?
Yeah, Titan guy, Doctor Who guy. Yeah.
Jordan and I did a comic that was in like the last ever Eagles Award. And he was chatting to us and some kind of controversy happened and we didn't win the award. But he said to us afterwards, he was like, oh, you were meant to win. And we're like, well, why didn't we? But I was chatting to Tony at this table and then Marv Wolfman walked past and he was like, you should talk to Marv Wolfman, like go and sell yourself, like big yourself up. So then he forced me into this conversation with Marv Wolfman, who didn't know who I was, could barely understand my accent, and you know, he's getting on as well. And yeah. I didn't, you know, what was I supposed to say to him? Be like, is it true that your name wasn't allowed to be in comics because it sounded like Wolfman? Like, isn't true, apparently.
Oh, we interviewed Wolfman, didn't we, at London Super Comic Con? Yeah, you guys.
Yeah, I speak to him. Yeah. He's a lovely guy. Just a super nice guy. I think he wasn't very well when we spoke to him. Was he down? I can't remember now, but I know me and Dan were super nervous.
That's right, I remember you saying, because I went, go over and fucking interview him, and you ran off, didn't you? That was during our incident with Mike Zeck as well, the same day as that, wasn't it? Yeah.
And it was one of those classic, you know, massive comic convention happening, a quiet little corner where you have one of the tent poles of the comic industry who's created so much, just quietly sitting there and no one's talking to him.
How are you guys with, like, big name comics guys? Because I worked at Traveling Man, the retail comics retailer, for years, so I met a few guys.
Yeah,
and it wasn't like I was trying to play it cool, but I tended to just think they just make comics, you know, like you had to kind of put that in your head. But then
you're a bit like that. We've had some sort of reasonably big names on the show, and I think the thing is, we rarely get nervous, do we? Because all you got to think about is I'm as good at my job as they were at their job. That's the way I often look at it. Yeah, you know. Yeah.
I think it's also a case of what you like, because if there's a creator, you know, there's some big names that I didn't necessarily, you know, they were not that I didn't like them, but you know, they weren't in my sort of wheelhouse. So I could I could follow like my friends up and like certainly like talking to Mike Zeck, for instance. I know Dan and Tony were like, "Oh my word!" And I was like, "Oh, mate."
Yeah. Well, we do have a reputation for being quite broadly humoured. I think you'll find, Rick, we just sort of whenever we meet a creator at a convention, we sort of throw ourselves into boob jokes, and then we do stuff like get Vince to pitch Vince and his cat.
No, you don't get that. No, you try to pitch that to fucking everyone, and it doesn't. It's nothing to do with me. I want to state on this episode, it's nothing to do with me. But I definitely have a sort of a geek moment where I'm just like, oh my God, I just bottle it. I do bottle it sometimes. I'm like, I can't talk to them.
I was bottling it with Jay Lee. Was it Jay Lee? No, the Frank Cho.
Frank Cho, yeah. I was the same with Frank Cho.
There's a few people who've got a reputation for being difficult in interviews. I'm doing a bit of research on Brian Azzarello at the moment, and he is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And I just don't think I'd want to speak to him because he's that difficult. You know, there's the few interactions I've had. Yeah, he's listen to the Word Balloon interview he does. It's painful. I almost wrote a complaint. He was just so rude. Yeah.
I was quite lucky to one of the regulars or semi-regulars when I was working in Star was Pete Doherty or Pete Doherty, I don't depend on you.
Did a lot of work.
Yeah, 2000 AD. And a lot of people find him difficult because he's so full on, but he's just very Yorkshire. That's all it is. He's not being pretentious. He's just like, it's like a Yorkshire machine gun firing in your face when he talks to you. But once you crack through that, he just, and then he started like, because he knows so many people in the industry, and he starts telling you about these big names and like stupid things he did. It really takes the shine off them. But you kind of be like, oh yeah, that guy sounds a bit like a bit of a knob, if we're honest, you know, like, but it's kind of, it's great. The one guy we got, Jordan and I both were kind of like doing that kind of, you know, like when you're a kid and you kick a ball over a fence, you're like, you knock on, no, you knock on, and you just won't go and talk to him, even though you like him.
Yeah.
We were really into Paul Grist. We both got really into Jack Staff. And he was just sat at this, like, everyone was ignoring him at this convention, like you're saying about Marv Wolfman. And we were like, that's Paul Grist. Why aren't people queuing up for miles to see him? And it was like, you know, Kieran Gillen was there. It was like when Phonogram Part 2 was just coming out, so he was like a rising star. And we were like, that's Paul Grist. And then I think in the end, Jordan went over and got like some signed copies and come back. And I was like, what was he like?
Well, we had a table next to Paul Grist.
Oh, really?
there's a story, yeah. Vince. And yeah. Someone came over to us and came over to the table and asked us how you get into comics or what's a good way to do something in comics. And we both went, well, we don't know, really. Why don't you ask Paul Grist? And what happened, Vince? Didn't we send, he moved a few feet over and said, have you got any idea about how to get into comics? He went, yeah, not really, no.
Yeah.
And we're like, thanks, Paul.
Yeah,
it's like one of those when you ask someone, so did you really enjoy making this page? Do you love using black inks? You know, what is your process? Do you really enjoy it? Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
great chat. Catch you later.
There's no mysticism to it, really, is there? Sometimes you're just like, yeah. No, I do it because I can't stop myself from doing it, and I don't know why I did it.
I think a lot of comic artists spend their time just locked away, don't they?
Yeah.
So often they're not particularly people persons, you know. Yeah. Some of them are, you know.
You know, everyone is themselves. You know, there's if someone is just quiet, then they're just quiet. There's no law saying that.
Yeah, you don't have to be Mr. Personality to be into comics. In fact, most of the time, I'd rather you fucking weren't at the moment, to be fair.
Yeah.
You spend your life making jokes on Twitter when you could be writing scripts or having a little snooze, Dan Slott.
Well, I guess it must be difficult. Sometimes you just kind of like fall into making comics. And try and give someone advice on how to do it. You'd be like, well, I don't know.
Want to give people advice. If I'm writing Spider-Man, I don't want to give people advice on how to write Spider-Man because they're going to take my job from me.
Yeah, there is that.
Like when I was starting out, I went, you know, I used to attend all those like how to break in, you know, lectures that the various people were doing. And then I went to one at Mark Miller's shortly lived comic convention, whatever that was. MillerCon.
Yeah, we were at that. Yeah.
I went to one and I seem to remember the editor of X-Men. Like the X-Men family of books saying something like, oh, there's no one way to get in. And basically once somebody gets in one way, that door closes and you have to find a new way. And I just thought to myself, there's absolutely no point in me coming to these anymore. Like that, like he's told the truth, which is like, no one can tell you the secret. It's like really cliche when they say, oh, just go and make comics. But we should say, go and make comics and don't think about it.
I like the Eddie Campbell quote. He says, and Eddie Campbell says this constantly. He says, if you're making comics, you're in the comics.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah. And I think, look at the sales numbers. There's not a huge divide now between indie, small press, big two. Some of the titles are selling about the same.
Yeah.
Web comics, that's the way to be. We know that now, don't we?
It's all about translating that into money, though, isn't it?
It is. Thing. Yeah. It depends if you want to make comics or make a living making comics.
That's very true.
I make comics and I sell my ass on the side just to, you know.
Oh god, like a slice of ham, right?
There's a good kind of like heart wrenching autobiographical story comic in there, like small press scene.
Don't be stealing that idea, Rick. I know what you like.
Yeah.
Getting back to the book, though. Yeah.
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh so yeah.
Were there many people you actually managed to speak to who appear in the book? Because I know a lot of it is based. I mean, there are some people who are still about and stuff. Is there anyone of note that you spoke to that you thought, oh, that's brilliant? I really had a good time speaking to that person.
Not so much. No. Like I know it sounds awful, but a lot of it I had to get from previous interviews, like a few people I spoke to get permission to be like, am I allowed to use this interview? But like the big problem is like so many of them are dead. I think I don't know, is Stanley being dead 2 years now or three? Basically around the time I started the book, either shortly after I'd kind of got the commission for it, I was in the planning phase, around then Stanley died. And I just thought, oh, like, he was basically the last of the notable Golden Age artists that you could possibly get to. So, no, I mean, like, apart from, I cannot, like, stress how much work Mark Nobleman did. And, like, he was, like, really nice about, and, like, asked him for pictures and stuff. Because he kind of, towards the end of the book, spoilers, when both Finger and Kane are dead. He really becomes like a kind of a driving force for how the narrative changes surrounding them too, like, cuz he was like genuinely part of the campaign. So yeah, it's kind of weird. I didn't speak to him, and like, obviously, like, when I sent off an email being like, supposed to email Jim Steranko, and it come back and it was like, hey baby, what do you want? And I was like, and then he got like, I don't know if he'll mind me saying this or whether he'll even hear it, he got kind of really shitty with me in the emails being like, well, what do you need, what's the exact bit? And it was like 11 o'clock at night over here, and my wife was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm emailing Jim Steranko. She's like, what is a Jim Steranko? And I was like, I don't have time to explain to you like how he revolutionized S.H.I.E.L.D. But like, then he got a bit dicky, and I had to say it to him. I was like, oh, Jim, like, I'm really sorry. I can't give you all this information out. It's quite late over here, and my wife doesn't want me working in the middle of the night. And he was like, don't worry about it, baby. I know how dames are, or something. Like,
that's how you want him to be.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that's good. Like, it's bought me 12 hours to go and get the info that I need from him. I was like, oh, you old sexist.
Yeah. Show us your syrup.
I've never used baby in my life to refer to someone. Do you know what I mean?
That's a lie, Dan.
Babes.
No, yeah, but like, not someone familiar, sort of like you talk to someone in the shop. Do you want to carry a bag with that? Oh, no, thanks, baby.
Thanks, baby. Thanks, baby. Yeah.
Someone from the 60s, you want, really, don't you?
Yeah,
you want an elderly
yeah.
man with incredibly white teeth and the thickest head of hair you've ever seen.
Yeah, well, let's call it hair. Let's say hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For legal reasons.
Yeah. He's Irish. Yeah. it seems to be creeping forward. Every time I see him at New York at that table, he seems to creep forward a little bit. He's always well dressed though, with like a polo neck on and a suit. He does do all that, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
Polo neck. Wow, that's a real old school comic creator's clothing, isn't it? Polo neck. I've never worn a polo neck.
We was mentioned about like the kind of the bad rep kind of. Well, Stan Lee seems to sort of swing from having a sort of a bad rep to people thinking he's kind of.
Some people hate him with a passion, don't they?
Yeah.
Some people, yeah.
Yeah, I never get. Well, I do get it, but like, I read that Danny Fingeroth book about him. I can't remember what, The Marvelous Life of Stan Lee, it might be called.
Right.
And even though like Fingeroth has worked for him and was quite close to him, it's kind of fair, and it does say like, you know, he. Like, Kirby's credits were on every single page, and you can't say the same about Bill Finger. It just, you know, it said Batman by Bob Kane, and that was it. On everything Stanley and Kirby did, it said Lee and Kirby, and all that, you know. So, and then when you hear like, oh, these interviews where he took all the credit, it's like, well, you know, if you read them and think, oh, if someone just asked you a question out of the blue, and, you know, someone said to me, oh, you created Hocus Pocus, and I wasn't quick enough to be like, actually, I created it with, you know, three other people. If I just said, yeah, I did, that wouldn't necessarily be trying to steal credit. And I think basically a lot of what you think Stan Lee did comes from what the reader thinks he did already. It's not kind of like, let's be open-minded.
Yeah, or it depends the audience he's speaking to, isn't it? I mean, I've had people jump down my throat because I forgot to mention the flatter on a fucking comics review. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, so the world changed a little bit. I've still got a soft spot for him. I don't think comics would be quite the same without Stan. I'll be honest with you.
No.
Utterly. And Jack neither, you know.
Yeah.
I've got real fondness for him.
I think as well, I think about Kirby as well, where later on in his career, he started to say, like, I created Spider-Man. And it's like, well, we know you didn't. Like, 100% we know it. Well, like, let's say 99.9%, we know it was Lee and Ditko.
There's a great moment in the In Search of Steve Ditko documentary where I think a lot of people say that Stan almost had a quiet moment, which was very unlike him, a thoughtful moment where he's asked, did you create Spider-Man or was it Steve Ditko?
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting moment. It's almost like the mask is pulled away a little bit and you see...
Okay.
He doesn't say it, does he? But it's the closest he comes to.
He says, I came up with the idea and I described him and eventually Steve drew him. Because I've got a feeling that Jack drew him first, didn't he? Is that right? I can't remember the exact timeline.
Did he?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a... I think they thought, oh, Jack wasn't suitable for Jack, so he went to Hull. I can't remember, to be fair, it'd be unfair of me to say, but he says, look, I did come up with the idea and I did hand it to an artist. You know, it's a little bit of that.
Mm.
It's hard to tell. Mm. You're right, though. Yeah. You wouldn't say, Rick, that's one of your problems, is trying to dig back through history to confirm this stuff and be fair. And
yeah,
it must be
but
real.
Then you're only going on people's thoughts and memories of what
and
they
decades know. And decades of different stories, and you know, you can't trust an echo sometimes because what you hear won't necessarily be the original words, is it really, that sort of thing.
That's one of the big things about Kane as well, like, not to give away like all the kind of twists and turns in the book, but there is a part where when his book comes out called Batman and Me, like he basically admits to saying, like, you know, Batman would not have been possible without Bill Finger, and basically he doesn't use the words co-created by Bill Finger, because he's still like, I'm not allowed to say it because I've lied about my contract, and it'll over, you know, there'll be this big legal machine that stops him from saying it. But then he tells a story of, like, he came to Finger with these sketches, and it's like, it's more like Birdman. He's got these kind of Da Vinci style wooden wings, and that, you know, Bill kind of says, oh, maybe we should make the wings more like flowing, so the scallops, and, you know, we'll change it. And basically he helps him create the design that is Batman. But then in the same book, like on the next page, it's got like original sketches, and oh, you can't see them, but I'm doing air quotes there, of original sketches that are like marked like 15 years before Batman is created, and it looks exactly like the Batman. You know,
oh, wow. I think I read this in your book.
So it kind of looks, you know, and it's a real shame, because like the kind of the one time he could have really gone as far as he legally could and said, yeah, he helped me do it, he kind of does this thing where he pretends that he had these old drawings and that Batman was fully formed in his mind, but then he's telling you the story on the next page that he didn't. So it's just he can't even keep his own story together. It's kind of amazing.
We've all seen that there's a comic strip by a guy called Ty Templeton.
Yeah,
that does, like, what Batman be like without Bill Finger. Have you seen that one?
Yeah,
and it's kind of like, that's pretty savage. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah, he almost certainly would have been like that. He's like in red, a big red suit, and he's got blonde hair.
Yeah,
and like that Batman cover, you know, the famous one where he's like swooping on the rope, and there's the two like mooks in the bottom corner. That's just like it's a tracing of a Alex Raymond Flash panel.
Yeah,
but like even the original design had the same kind of Flash's uniform almost, and didn't, you know, had a weird cape.
Oh, okay, right.
That's it's bizarre, but I would guess, like you said, he's kind of like almost hamstrung now, to the point where he couldn't say anything,
because
it would open up the floodgates for potential sort of lawsuits, and it's never happened.
He keeps stumbling, so there's like a kind of a fascinating quote someone said about him, whose name is escaping me right now, but he said that he was once at Finger's house, and Kane they were at Kane's house, and Finger come in, and Finger was like really like reverential to Bob Kane, and being like, you know, like just like bowing down to him, and not in like a mocking way, in like a genuine like, I'm grateful to be here. And there's another story of Kane's mum brings in food for the boys, because they are like, you know, they're young, they're early 20s, they are just boys. And like, there's like a really big juicy steak on one plate, and then hamburger on the other. And the guest gets like the crappier meal, basically. And Bob's just like, you know, in my head, I was thinking about it. I was like, oh no, if that were my house, the guest would always get the best meal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob just doesn't seem to care that his guest is getting the worst meal. And like, kind of my summary of it is like, yeah, you know, that kind of plays out psychologically throughout his career. Everyone's getting fed, but Bob's getting the most because he thinks he should get the most. And it's not like no one else is getting left out. They're just not getting as much as he is. And, you know, if you think of it like that, it does humanize him a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a curious mindset. I don't understand that. I don't know if anyone else feels that way, but you always want to see people kind of get what they deserve, and everyone gets a fair cut. But if you haven't been brought up like that and you don't hold those ideals, why wouldn't you?
I mean, the comics industry wasn't something anyone knew about. I suppose that was also a problem for you, Rick. But back then, nobody really knew about it, did they? It's not like now where everything you do in comics is plastered all over Bleeding Cool or Twitter or somewhere.
Oh, yeah. It's something I kind of touched on later on, is like, we you know, there's a bit of a like temporal privilege we have now. Well, like, even the guys who started Image, like, changed creators' rights. And before that, there were like various little, you know, like wars in the comics industry about trying to get creators' rights.
Yeah.
But, you know, if Todd McFarlane, I mean, God, could you imagine if Todd McFarlane existed in 1939? But that's a different baseball day. Like, the idea that any one of those people could go into a room and say, you need to pay me more money because I come up with this little doodle that you sell to children. And all, like, also, the guys they would have been asking, particularly at DC, were rumored to be connected to the mob.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of them was like a union, had been a former union socialist. And then after he was like, I'm sick of socialism, I'm becoming like a hardline capitalist, like, you know, like 1940 style capitalist. Like, the people they were playing with weren't easy to get. Oh, they were like hard-nosed bastards. And then they knew how to work their way around by, you know, there's a thing about Donenfeld, who was like the owner of DC National. He wouldn't pay the Superman boys the money they needed, but then he'd like buy them. He'd just be like, oh, here's a 30 grand bonus, because he knew that giving them a little bit would stop them asking for more in the long run. Or he paid for Joe Suster's eyesight surgery once. And that was like, I'll just string you along, you know.
That story you tell about him leaning on a car and getting arrested was incredible, man. I didn't know that at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got like that was in Bob Kane's book, and I was like,
all right.
But
what's the story?
Oh,
for listeners.
Yeah.
So Bob Kane and Joe Shuster go on holiday to Miami.
That sounds brilliant already.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. And Bob's waiting for dinner, and he's like, you know, Shuster's not showing up. He's like, what the hell's going on? It turns out that Shuster's like walking down the street. He sees a really nice car, but of course his eyesight was absolutely terrible. So he leans on the car to get his, you know, a better look at the interior and stuff. And two police officers find him and think he's trying to steal it. So they arrest him and throw him in jail, like in jail. And he's trying to plead with them, being like, no, I've got bad eyesight. They're like, yeah, okay, what do you do, kid? And he's like, I draw Superman for a living. Like, absolutely not. No way. but then Kane finds out somehow, and he finds Harry Donenfeld, who also happens to be in Miami at the time. And like, he goes down and like glad hands all these cops, and is like, "Yeah, he's my artist." And they're like, "Oh, it's, you know, it's entirely a mistake." And then like Shuster even then does the like Superman sketches to be like, "Yeah, like no worries, officer." And like Kane, like again, like Kane tells the stories if it's like the most funny thing in the world. Like, "Oh, this happened to my pal," and then like later on, he's like, you know, when there was a dispute over Superman rights and they came to me and said, hey, if the creators of Superman and the creators of Batman stood against the company for creator rights, you know, we could get some money. And then he was like, nope, not doing that. Screw you guys. I'm going to get money for myself. So it's, again, it's like kind of like, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that like Bob Kane was probably not a likable person and was very selfish. But I don't know if he's the kind of...
So he's not your role model for how you collaborate with Jordan.
Yeah, right.
Well,
Bob Kane. I'm not an idiot. Like a bit of role play? Yeah.
I am an idiot. I know. But the only way I get around it is I say, well, Bob Kane was technically the artist, so, you know, how could I be like him? Now work harder and faster.
Just have my name on it.
Yeah.
Top right hand corner.
Wow, as if by magic, with a puff of smoke and audio effect that I'll add later. Yes, I will actually add it this time, guys.
Go on.
I heard it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. We're joined by another guest and the artist of Hocus Pocus and Rick's collaborator, Jordan Culver. Hello, sir.
Hello, pleased to
hey,
be
Jordan.
Here, guys. Thanks.
We're
for welcome,
having Jordan.
Now, obviously, once
so
again...
So ask my question.
Oh, go on. God, go on.
Did you base the title of your new comic on the famous Bette Midler movie?
That was my first association. We had a few alternate titles. I said my strongest childhood association is that film. And I don't think Richard Wiseman, I'm not sure what to call him, our creative
consultant.
I don't think he was familiar with the film. Rick, I know you were, but it wasn't strong enough that we
Rick has been talking nonstop while we've been waiting for you to come on about Hocus Pocus and Bette Midler's barnstorming. barnstorming performance in the movie.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's definitely the first Google hit, and we at least maybe should have spelt it with a K instead of a C, but when you type in Hocus Pocus with a K, Google still goes, do you mean the Batman Hocus Pocus with a C?
Even for a while, we weren't even the top hit for Hocus Pocus comic. There's another comic out there called Hocus Pocus that's like a kind of fantasy adventure thing. And you know what? I've avoided looking at it because I'm like, I don't need to know about these people. They don't need to know about us. There doesn't need to
They're
be a
dead
fight.
To me already.
Because everyone needs to know about this comic, which of course we talked about a bit during Thought Bubble, where you were planning to last year, where you were planning to have a table and sort of launch it fully at Thought Bubble. Was that correct? Or was that the year before?
Yeah, this Thought Bubble just gone.
Is a weird thing.
What's
now,
happened?
Isn't it?
You mean 2020?
Yeah, 2020.
Yeah, 2020 would have been our big kind of reveal. Like, here it is. It's the first time the public's seen it, and then they didn't.
And you was that
you were stuck
two?
On some terrible podcast talking
was that
about
issue
it.
Two or issue three? Because you've got three issues now.
I actually, I can't remember. We've released every single one of them in lockdown. The first one was right at the start of, like, that was in March. So that was right at the start. And then we created the other two since then.
It was issue three, I think. I think every release of an issue of Hocus Pocus heralds a lockdown. Like, like, it's every single one within a week of it coming out, it's like, oh, national lockdown. I think, like, God is trying to stop this comic from being seen or something. I mean, or Boris Johnson is.
I mean, maybe it's like the magic circles and all of those people who just don't want the secrets being revealed. But saying that, already three issues down, it's five issues in total, isn't it? I believe. Am I correct there?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, we're working on the fourth one now, and then the fifth one. We'll hopefully kind of have the whole kit and caboodle finished by the end of the summer. I think that's the plan.
Wow, that would be amazing. I mean, this series, for those who don't know it or missed out on the Thought Bubble special, it's an informative and fascinating book series about basically, like, as it says on the cover, science, magic and mystery, and looking at the stories behind some of, like, legends and myths and all this, the supernatural, paranormal, vaudeville and stuff. How would you describe it? We're at the Thought Bubble table. Someone comes over and goes, what's this about? Because that's how people talk at a comic convention. What do you tell them?
John, you're the writer, Rick.
I knew you were going to do that. I've been describing it in emails to people as a comic book about the psychology and science of the supernatural as told through, like, the history of magic. And hopefully that, like, hits every kind of key demographic that it's kind of aimed at. A lot of it is us trying to have our cake and eat it, because a lot of it is just science. Like, a lot of this is just, like, why do people make these common cognitive mistakes? A lot of it is, like, the history of stage magic. But then, to look at that, basically we're using the history of stage magic to look at why people believe in supernatural or magical things. And then each issue kind of looks at a different phenomena. So issue one was mind reading. Issue two was seances. Yeah. Issue three was ghosts. Issue four, I think we're allowed to tell you. I'm going to tell you anyway. Who's going to stop me? Is what have we called it, Jordan?
The prophecy. It's not a secret. It's on the website. I've done.
Oh,
the
cover. You posted the cover. Yeah. Richard Wiseman's done an interview with a different website today, and he sent us the interview. And he's real, because he's a magician. He's really cagey about any information. And he does a very good job of just not answering the question that they've given them by, like, it seems like he's explained what they've asked him, but when you look at it, he goes, wait a minute, he's just avoided telling them anything here.
Because this is, one of the great things about this book is, like, it's a different subject every issue, which is great. So if you can read it non-sequentially if you want or anything like that. But also, like you say, Professor Richard Wiseman was a collaborator, etc. I mean, how did the book sort of come to be? Because it's fascinating reading this whole series.
He's sort of like the showrunner in a way. It was his idea. We'd worked with him in the past, Rick and I, on a couple of little projects with him. He has a Quirkology YouTube channel, and he does stuff associated with that.
Was that also sort of non-fiction sort of stuff?
Yeah, he does like magic and sleight of hand oriented trickery on that. Mm. And I think he just wanted to do a couple of little illustrative and comic strips. We did a couple with him, just like one pagers.
Yeah.
And Rick, am I right in thinking he got in touch with us to do that because he saw our Houdini and Doyle short? Is that why?
Yeah, John and I were thinking about, we were trying to get a graphic novel off the ground, and we'd made this pitch and we made this like 8-page proof for it. Mm. And I was researching it, and he said on Twitter, like, if anyone in the next 15 minutes, if anyone asks me to explain any magic trick, I will. And I must have been the only person who saw it, because I replied and I was like, I need to know how Houdini did this trick with Conan Doyle in this room on this day, because I was like that deep into the research. And he just replied saying, oh, funnily enough, I've just been reading about that. And then he's never to this day told me. But I think once he'd seen that, I think maybe I'd sent him the comic as well, or I'd posted about it. And then from that, he just one day contacted us and said, the first thing I think we ever did was this kind of trick page, and I want to do a page about how Houdini made an elephant disappear. And I want to be able to make the reader make the elephant disappear. Mm. So there is the first thing we ever did with like this one page story that you cut into four, and then you turn each of the four segments, and then when you put it back together, the elephant that is in the middle disappears. And that was like how it all started. We kind of just kept doing bits, some bits that we weren't allowed to publish because the people involved weren't happy with the how they were depicted in it.
Because I'm a terrible artist.
Yeah.
Oh no! Do you know what? I completely disagree. I love. I mean, these books from cover to cover, I absolutely love them. And also Owen Watts on the colours as well does an absolutely fabulous job. And I mean, I was saying to Rick before we started recording, but just the first issue alone melted my brain. Because what you guys do as well, and I know you're both very much buy the physical copy, you'll get the most out of it from the physical copy, because we all love the physical copies because they're the best. That's why we've got bookshelves after all. Yeah. But the digital still works because, you know, obviously I downloaded copies of the books. And the way that you guys have both done the information, told stories, because it's almost like small, it's like an anthology comic in a way, isn't it? Telling small historical moments or stories behind the magic or illusion. But the way you play with the reader to get them to focus on something, you use the tricks of these trades in the pages themselves as well, don't you? You play with how comics are read and yeah. Get to fool the reader. I mean, you fooled me. I mean, I was like, bloody hell, that worked.
Oh, I mean, it's always nice to hear if that works. You know, like, huh,
and then
work?
When you're describing it afterwards, I always think, hang on, am I an idiot because I believed all this?
That thing we said let's not talk about it. But when we had to like, oh, it's supposed to be available digitally, we had to really think like, well, what can we do? So like, even in that first issue, if you go onto the website and sneak around, there are more tricks in that first issue than we actually tell you about. In this, with a physical copy, you can perform some tricks to like other people. Supposed to reveal it. It's supposed to be like for magicians only. But what I would say is, if you went around out the website and went onto all the pages and went over every images, you'd find a secret link that would take you to a page, and it would be like, oh, I can do all these extra things in the book. But yeah, when it comes to designing it, like one of the things we were terrified of, or I was terrified of, is it just suddenly feel like, oh, hey, we're explaining how mesmerism works, blah, 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 blah. And now here's a mesmerist trick that's just totally not part of the story, just suddenly like, oh, and now here's a demonstration, and it not feel integrated.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. But it all flows very well with the reading experience, isn't it? Which is essentially paramount, isn't it? You know, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like... it's both informative to find out, you know, to get a peek behind the curtain, but also you're talking about historical figures, and that's what, you know, this episode's also about. These are real living, breathing people that pulled the wool over people's eyes or perhaps started a certain thing, certainly with, I believe, the seance, the sisters, who were doing something that was funny, and then that completely took off. I had no idea about Ouija boards. That's fucking blown my mind.
Yeah, they're just a game. I mean, there's so much folklore surrounding it, and it's literally just like
it started as a game you could buy at Christmas and stuff, didn't it?
Yeah. Like people were doing that kind of thing for free, and then someone was like, "I can copyright that and make money off it." I remember a guy I worked with, whose nickname was like Spooky, because he was really deep into like kind of 4T and stuff, and would not play with a Ouija board because he was positive that one of us would get possessed by Pazuzu. But I remember saying to him, I was like, you know that Hasbro owns the copyright to it? And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, how could Hasbro own the copyright to an occult item? Like,
Don't play Monopoly.
We wouldn't go that evil as to play Monopoly.
But how much of this stuff did you know beforehand, or was it the collaboration with Richard Wiseman that sort of let you in the door of this, you know, because you're sitting on a lot of secrets that you can't tell, otherwise you'll get taken out now, aren't you? Basically, the both of you.
Well, Rick, you have a pretty unique skill. It seems to me like you pretty much knew all of the baseline material already, and you just kind of needed to dig a little bit deeper to actually put the script together. But, you know, in our initial meeting with Richard Wiseman, Rick seemed to already know, okay, well, we'll do this, this, and this. And I was like, wait a minute, Pepper's Ghost, what's that? Oh, and what's this? So from my perspective as the artist, it was really fun to kind of learn about a lot of it. I had a passing knowledge of some of the stuff, but I was kind of learning as I drew it. And then once you start looking at it, you know, because I would do lots of my own visual research for reference and, you know, to get the characters and settings right. And then you realize all the other material that, Rick did such a good job of sifting through, because so much of this stuff is crazy and really interesting, and you can go down so many rabbit trails. Mm. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe this coincidence or that this happened. But then, you know, how he's kind of woven it together into just what we want to tell based on that theme is quite cool. But it seemed to me like you knew quite a lot already, didn't you, Rick?
Yeah, I can't remember, because I've always kind of been interested in magic anyway. Like, I grew up watching The Masked Magician and like Jonathan Creek, but I was never dedicated enough to actually become a magician. So it was just, I think when we were researching this Houdini and Doyle book, I'd read a couple of books about Houdini, then a couple of books about Conan Doyle, then a couple of books about them together, and then obviously there's things that the magic historians, like comic historians, wouldn't put in the book, like wouldn't tell you, like, for example, how did he make the elephant like vanish? Because no one's ever done that. No one's ever really kind of figured out how that trick was done. So then I wanted to find that out. So then I got into a book called Vanishing an Elephant by Jim Steinmeier. And then he does loads of these books. And I think, I don't know if it's Steinmeier's quote, but it's definitely a magic historian's quote, is like, the best place to hide a secret is to publish it in a book, because no one reads them. But like, once you kind of get into magic history, all these little things start popping up, and you start to see all these little connections between people and, you know, little isolated stories. So a lot of it I did know, but then when you're speaking to Wiseman, it's like a Google search. You know, if you're thinking, you know, like, oh, wait, who's this guy in this film? And it's on the tip of your tongue. He knows straight away what you're talking about, how it's done. The trick is like kind of teasing it out. A lot of the conversations I had with him, it would be me putting forward methods, being like, so I presume when someone does this, this is how this is done. And he never like, yes, that is how it's done. It's always kind of like a, you are very much on the right track. So it's kind of a mystery even with them. But then sometimes, you know, I'm like, we need a method. I need to know how I get someone to select this card. And he will be like, right, we can use this. It's fairly commonplace. You can get it in, you know, most beginner's magic books. So yeah, it's 50-50.
There's methods to it as well, isn't it? I mean, there's, and the book is also very interactive, which I really like about it as well. You know, I think rather than just telling the reader, you're getting them involved. One of my favourite moments of it is also in the first issue, where it's inviting the reader to look around a room to see where the note is, and like they have to pick a number, and there's these boxes and they have to fight. I won't spoil it for you folks, because you should experience it for yourself, because I did it in the way that they said, and it worked. I was like, how? But then it's the sort of methods, isn't it? It's the tells. Yeah. It's the knowing how people are going to act before the people even know how they're going to act sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. That one was our sort of boldest, because that was the debut issue. I think that one we put the most kind of oomph into figuring out really how to emphasize that interactive element. The other ones, we're always trying to get for like one centerpiece element per issue. But that one, I think, we wanted to come out strong. Incidentally, what was kind of fun about that is because the issue is about that character, Washington Irving Bishop, we're trying to explain how he would, sense people's micro movements in their body in order to quote unquote read their mind about where an object was hidden in the room. Yeah. Obviously, we can't do that in a comic. So it's a different kind of trick that we used, the method that we used. Not related to reading micro movements or anything, but within the context of the story and the way we set it up and the way we frame it and execute it, it feels right for a comic, right? Because there's no other way to do it. So we just do what feels like a mind reading trick, to simulate that.
Interesting because like you set up that whole, this is the way that the person thought about it, and it almost tests it on the reader immediately. I think rather than thinking, oh my god, this book is possessed, burn it, the readers get like, that's fascinating, where does it go from here, And also you tie it into the the narrative as well. The reader is trying to find a note that's saying that this guy isn't dead, he's paralyzed, please don't kill, please don't remove my brain, which unfortunately in real life no one found the note, and they took it.
All that bit is true about, like, it's entirely true that happened to that guy. And it's just that, that one in particular, I think, when we were discussing Wiseman, I thought he thought he was going to get kind of like, oh, I'll get comics and they'll do like little tricks and it'll be fine. And I remember when he got that one back, he was like, wait a minute. He was like, you've told us it's one method. Like, he was like, very much like a magician. You've told us what you're going to do, and then you've done it, but using the method that, not the method you've described. The trick is integrated into the narrative. It's not just like, he doesn't suddenly out of nowhere go, and now for no reason, pick a card. There's a reason why you're doing it. Yeah. And he was really like, oh, this is going to... I mean, he always thought it was going to work, but I think that was when he was like, oh, this is good. Like, this is a lot better than I thought it was going to be. Yeah.
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 I think that one in particular is... Richard Wiseman's favorite, at least it seems to be. For example, he wrote a paper, an academic paper based on it. He ran an experiment. Rick and I are co-authors of a sort on that paper, incidentally. It's under peer review right now. It's been accepted. It will be published in the Journal of Science Communication at some point in the near future. Oh, nice. He ran an experiment kind of using that story in particular, that Washington Irving Bishop story, as sort of the sample. And, he was testing people's retention of information, their enjoyment of it and so on, compared to, say, just ordinary text version of the same story, which was kind of neat. But I found it interesting, he picked that story, I think, because it does the best job of maybe quickly demonstrating something different to just a normal comic. But yeah, that was kind of cool as well. It was fun to see some research come out of it.
Oh, good stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
They're not easy to write, those journal. I'm writing one at the moment. Yeah, Christ.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing the amount of info. Because sometimes with these sort of books and that are like about a certain subject, especially some historical subject, sometimes it can seem quite dry. And very much like, when you're a school kid and you're looking at this book that's probably got some sort of historical importance next to an asterisk, you're going to pick the asterisk. Whereas this one, you're constantly playing with the reader, and it was constantly enjoyable from page to page. And also, fair play, because like we said before, you love the printed copy and you play with that. I mean, that the issues are available to download now, guys, and you really should. But also, I know there's some of you out there who don't like digital comics. Sarah Harris, you always want a printed book, and you should get the printed books of these, because you actually do tricks involving printed work that people wouldn't necessarily get in the digital, don't you?
That Mad Magazine thing, man. I love Mad Magazine. I could listen to those guys all day. And the fact you've homaged it a bit with that fold, I love that.
The fold's one of my favourite things in it, because I wrote it in the script, and then you can't just write a fold into a script. It don't make any sense to be like, So I had to make all these little diagrams in my thumbnail that I sent to Jordan, preposterously bad. It's amazing that not only that he can read them, that he still associates with me. But we made it, and then I don't want to speak for Jordan, but I feel like Jordan didn't fully get it until he'd drawn it himself and did the full.
You did a mock-up as well. You kind of recorded how it would work on your phone, and then I watched that and I was like, oh right, okay. And then I needed to actually draw that for real, which was fun.
The great thing about that is a guy who kind of really got into our books, a magician in Scotland, he bought a copy and then sent us a message being like, you bastards, because you're making me fold a page in a comic, which is sacrilege.
Yes, exactly.
And he said, I have to order another copy that'll be the folded one and the unfolded one. And I wasn't like,
I see. You cunning marketing bastard. Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of that, but I was like, we should print more.
That was Jim Lee when he did that cover. You could scratch and it looked like blood was coming off it. I'm sure that's the reason he did it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's the image revolution over again. That's what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, we're destroying comics.
If you write that book, I'll read it, my friend. I tell you that.
But you also do the great trick of the seance with the ghost, and turn over and you can see the real thing that's happening, which still works digitally. Actually, I can still see exactly what you're doing, but to see it on the printed, there's nothing quite like a trick or some sort of effect that's pulled off in a printed book, is there?
Yeah, there's a few places where it just doesn't. We tried our best where to replicate, say, a trick with the page fold in the digital version, for example. I just created a separate file where it just simulates it as if the reader was folding it, so it replicates the image rather than just kind of folding it over. But for this one, for the listeners, basically, we're asking the reader to shine a light through the physical page to reveal. You end up seeing through the page to see what's on the other side, and it kind of makes it look like you're shining a light in the dark. At least that's the idea. And I think we were all surprised when we saw it. We were all kind of surprised by how well it worked. It was sort of like, okay, that'll be fun. Maybe it'll be semi-effective, even if it's not. People should hopefully take it with a pinch of salt and kind of think, huh, neat, and move on. But it worked, I think, better than we thought, and it was pretty neat to see. But with that, like you say, there's no real way to replicate that on the digital one, so all you have is the two different images and leave it up to their imagination. But that's just more incentive to get the paper copy while they're around.
Totally. But you also play with the – and Jordan, the way you play with layouts and stuff, which ties into the covers and the back cover of issue 3 – which, when you read the is it Henry Dirks?
Yes.
That was one that him on the back cover, because when you read the story of him, which is kind of tragic in a way, and another example of, as we've previously touched on before, credit where credit is due when it comes to, creations and things like that, and Pepper's ghost, for instance. These are all fascinating things. I know certainly the supernatural, when people were into that, they're really into that, aren't they? The paranormal and stuff, people love that. Otherwise, there wouldn't be shows on Discovery all the time about, or whatever, UK TV Play or whatever. Was it Ghost Watch? Ghost Hunters.
Psychic Fairs. I love a psychic fair, mate.
Yeah. There's Ghost Hunters. Ghost Hunters. The thing is, I think Rick and I both the same. I really am interested in the supernatural stuff, but without kind of accepting any of it as reality. So it's kind of a weird position to be in, where
kind of a positive skeptic. that kind
of. There's lots of people who just go, it's all bullshit, or baloney.
You can say no shit.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
This whole show is shit.
They'll be like, it's all bullshit, and then just kind of that's it. That's sort of the end of the conversation, or they'll only use it as something to laugh at. I think it's really cool, and it's really interesting, and there's lots of cool stuff associated with it. Mind you, it can be very frustrating when there is sort of the true believer side of things. You know, because there's a lot of neat stuff going on with the brain, and just the subculture can be quite interesting as well. And the history, like, you know, that's why it doesn't matter what you believe. You read these stories about these people, and I think most people will say that it's pretty fascinating, whether you have an interest in it or not. But I think that sort of puts us in a weird category of creators or readers. There are others like us, but, you know, a lot of the times people will fall into one camp or the other, whereas I'm fully willing to entertain very engaged conversations with people who completely believe in ghosts, even if I think they are sorely mistaken.
Yeah. It's like, you know, hacking back to earlier when I was saying, you know, kind of, I was briefly into the kind of new atheist movement. I think Jordan was at the same time, but then I kind of, you know, stopped because those, you know, a lot of them were just dicks to people. Yeah. I still say this to Jordan to this day, is, you know, when people say, like, isn't science just better than magic? Like, isn't the universe beautiful enough without having to believe in magic? And I always say, no, 100% magic would make the universe more interesting. Like, why deny that fact? Like, the universe would be better if there were dragons, but there's not. So, you know, like, particularly from a design perspective as well, like, it's better to draw a real ghost than it's to draw a man in a sheet. Like, that will always look better.
Yeah.
And it just sells it to people. So, I mean, we're allowed to kind of have it both ways, where we can draw, if we want, you know, Jordan can draw a real ghost up until we reveal what the secret is, and then it's not a real ghost. Like, visually, you sell the reader that's what people are seeing. They're just mistaken.
Yeah. And when it comes to that, sometimes people can't separate the creator from their creation in terms of, like, you know, how much popular fiction is all based on supernatural, you know, myths, monsters, ghosts and stuff. And someone could create a huge ghost story, and they'll always get there. So do you believe in ghosts? No.
You know what I mean? Well, yeah, of course you don't. You're not mad.
No. But it doesn't stop it being, you know, just an endless fountain.
I still watch
fountain.
The Entity a lot. I still watch that movie a lot.
Oh, Christ.
Jeez, Tony.
But, you know, the supernatural is an endless fountain of creativity, isn't it? You know, the possibilities. But certainly when it was at its sort of heyday, it is those sort of turn-of-the-century stories that you're... And the vaudeville and the stage shows, you know, I find that fascinating, how those became such a thing, you know, because obviously pre-TV, pre-all of everything.
And, well, it's really interesting to learn or to realize how much of... like the conventions within supernatural tropes and just belief in general come from that era. Like, you know, something like the Ouija board, say, as such modern day kind of urban myths and stuff associated with it, or even just the way that we think of how ghosts look or how seances work and all this stuff, it all kind of just dates back to that turn of the century, roughly, era, where people were kind of going through this spiritualist craze, and then the individuals responsible for popularizing that.
Yeah, and also the genre of fiction as we see it now was just mainstream fiction back then, wasn't it? It's super popular. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, in some cases, like in the second issue, we explore one of a very popular author. She was writing, purporting to be, you know, in contact with a spirit who is actually the author. So, you know, that crosses the fourth wall, kind of, where it's this ghost, you know.
Do you mean Grant Morrison? Is that what you're talking about?
That's right. That's right. Time traveling Grant Morrison.
But also you've got, like, Houdini was very much one of those, all right, then show me exactly how it's all, you know, someone who wants to believe but wants, you know, and there's the Houdini Doyle sort of dynamic and stuff that you touch on. But a great like the way Houdini looks, he's such a visual person, isn't he, Harry Houdini? I mean, the hair alone, but you've captured it, like, the shape of his head is so unique.
I must have, you know, forced Jordan to draw Houdini so many times. like, if you go onto the Hocus Pocus website, you can I think it's still on though. You can download a little the proof we did for that graphic novel we never managed to actually sell. A
Certain Symmetry.
That's the one, yeah. And for that, because we were really gearing up for it to be like, we've got, you know, 60 pages of script and we've got this really good idea and we taught the story like to death and all these three acts and everything. And then because it was a kind of a, you know, well, do you want to talk about the style, Jordan? Sorry, you're here for that.
I mean, the style, if you compare the two, they're quite different. I mean, it's been a number of years now since we did that. I'm sort of moving the Hocus Pocus style is more minimalist and cartoony than the Hocus Certain Symmetry is. But that's only because, you know, that was 8 pages. I could do a lot, put a lot more time into kind of the rendering and stuff. But and also just stylistic development I've had over the past few years. How long ago was that, Rick? That must have been like 4 years ago now, at least.
Certain Symmetry.
Yeah.
6 years ago, I reckon.
Good Lord. Okay, 6 years. Yeah. Right.
So if you came back to do it now, it would be a completely different looking kind of book if you chose to do that book.
Yeah, I think I definitely would. I'd probably make it look like I was trying a little.
We talked about kind of going again and trying to do it as a graphic novel, but trying to make it a comedy by just changing the style. And because, like, if you've believed it, it's quite like heavy going. Like, it's so frustrating. People say, that's the best thing you've ever done. And you're like, oh my God, it was 6 years ago. But yeah, sometimes we're like, oh, you know, it's all the material still there. We could still do it. But like, what if we just made it like a funny knockabout comedy?
Yeah, two buddies just about town.
It was really fun. With magic. That's what it'll be.
Well, see, that was the first. There was that TV show, wasn't there? Was it called Houdini and Doyle? With Steve Mangan, who I really like, actually. And then some guy playing Houdini who looked nothing like him. But that was sort of, I don't know, it was tenuously based on their relationship, but it was otherwise. That's an example where they did introduce, I think, genuine supernatural elements to it. Mm. It's sort of like a bit X-Files-y.
Gotcha.
I didn't actually watch the show, so actually I'm going to stop talking about it.
I remember we were still kind of working on the graphic novel. I remember that coming out and just completely deflated as being like, well, no one's going to be interested in this now. Like, that's just ruined it for everyone. Like, it's just a steaming pile of crap's just come out. It's definitely put people off.
Yeah, they just sort of went with a completely different angle. But it was really fun to draw Houdini again in the second issue because I had drawn a lot of sketches and stuff. I mean, like you say, the man has a very interesting physique and face anyway, and then kind of looking at that through a cartooning lens is really fun. And he actually has a lot of really different looks too throughout his performing career, you know, through the 20s up until he died in, gosh, when did he die? 50s, Rick? When was it? Late 40s?
27.
He died in 27?
A Canadian punched him to death.
Yeah. Okay, so look, that shows how much I know. That's several
Was that the classic, I will hold my abs and you punch me?
He had
appendicitis.
Appendicitis, yeah. And some. I mean, the conspiracy is that he was assassinated by spiritualists because there's like a really tenuous link between the guy who punched him and the president of not McMaster's University, whichever university he was at, was like a head of a spiritualist church. So there's a kind of a little conspiracy theory that they went out of their way to kill him.
I think it was McGill University.
McGill, yes.
Ontario, which is, I mean, I know people who went there back home in Canada. But yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions about his death, conspiracies aside. But basically, he had been suffering for like a full week with appendicitis. He probably would have died of sepsis pretty soon anyway. Like his appendix was just leaking toxins into his gut for days on end, but he kept performing because he's tough as nails, I guess. But he had this thing, like kind of a general standing challenge to people that, you know, he has the stomach of iron, so you can punch him and he'll be all right. And
Tony, then you've got that as well, haven't you, Tony?
Yeah, I do that often when I've had a good drink. Yeah.
And, you know, there is this macho jock dude studying at McGill, and he just came up to him after a show, and Houdini, you know, obviously wasn't feeling great, so he was reclining, And he's like, all right then. So he's getting up and he hasn't like fully gotten ready or anything yet. And as he's just kind of standing up, this guy just biffs him right in the gut. And I think, you know, then it's often reported that the punch kills him, when really I think that just exacerbated what was going on inside there anyway. And then, you know, he died shortly thereafter. But
I mean, the real story isn't always as glamorous as the legends that we create, is it?
No, let's stick with assassinated by spiritualists.
it's like the Bruce Lee thing, isn't it? It's much more exciting.
Yeah.
What happened to the guy who punched him? Did he face any kind of like blowback for that?
I don't think so. I think because it was like Houdini's kind of thing. It was like his challenge. And I think basically because he said, yes, you can do it, but I'm not prepared yet. Also, it was, he had a pre-existing condition. I think he died 7 days later. I don't quote me on this, but I feel like that guy had a quite terrible life after. I think he became an alcoholic and I think he died quite early. I don't know if that's related to the guilt of killing literally the most famous man on the planet. but, you know, it could easily be connected.
Yeah, bloody hell. Well, I mean, all of that, I mean, from Houdini to magic and all, you know, there's so much. I mean, you've learned quite a lot this episode, haven't you, folks?
Yeah,
the history of comics, the history of the paranormal, supernatural, etc. But at the end of the day, you really need to get the books that these guys are putting out, because they're very, very good. And you know, also order the physical copies. You know, firstly, Rick, when is the Batman book out?
April 30th, and that's available for pre-order from penandsword.com or Pen and Sword White Owl. If any combination of those words, you'll end up with my book.
It'll be on Amazon, I'm sure, won't it?
I hope so. Maybe.
Yeah, surely will be.
So, and we'll put a link in the show notes so you can pre-order that now. And Hocus Pocus itself, and you, where can people find that and you guys?
Hocus Pocus has a website called hocuspocuscomic.com. That should take you there. And you'll find more info about the comic itself. And then from there, you can download or order the issues. Unfortunately, I believe the first issue is
sold out.
No longer in print. Yeah. We've already done a couple of print runs of that.
Oh, wow.
And I think we sort of agreed we can't keep printing them forever. Mm-hmm. It would be kind of nice to do another one, but... yeah, at least the first issue is still available digitally, and then the other two issues out now are still available in print, and obviously we'll be doing the same with the next two as well. But
I believe sign up to like a newsletter so people are notified when issues come out and stuff, aren't they?
Oh, good shout.
Yeah. We should point out as well that the download is pay what you like. Obviously, we'd enjoy you sending us some money, but if you want to download it for free, just read it. Yeah, that's absolutely fine.
For anyone who does down it for free, just send their names to us and we'll read them out in the air.
With the shame bell.
No, it's kind of nice in a way, because, I mean, we were lucky enough to have some funding for the project from like an educational group that funded it. So that was, the production was already taken care of. So we weren't, you know, we didn't need to get profits from it in that way, and any of the money we get from the sales we just go back into you know, the next print run. So in a way it's been nice to be relieved of, like, I don't know, pressure to have sales and stuff, because by releasing it for free, I get a ping in my inbox every time someone downloads it, and the majority of them are free, but I suspect that all those people probably wouldn't have read it anyway if it had to get the physical paid copy. So it's nice. It just gets more eyeballs on it in a way.
We obviously hope not your email gets that, but several more pings over the next few days and weeks.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on social media and like find out more about your work as well?
I'm just on Twitter. I am on Instagram as well, but there's absolutely no point following me on there. I'm on Twitter just as @Ritworth. I would say to people, only follow me if you are interested in comics and politics. if you don't want someone mouthing off about how bad the government is, which I know is that's basically what Twitter is for now.
Seems that way.
You know, just come in tentatively.
I'm also on Twitter. It's my name, at Jordan Culver. And I may have an Instagram account. I've tried twice to do something on there, but don't. I think there's no. I have 14 followers, and I don't have one single image up on Instagram. So do not go.
Guys, I had to try to explain to Jordan how to upload an image to Instagram, and he was
not
like,
"Worth it."
Well, I mean, it would be if you just download the app to your phone. You lunatic! You're just like, nope. I've decided to do this the hardest way possible. I'm going to send a letter to the fine people at Instagram.
I use my computer for the internet. Is that so hard to understand? I don't use my phone. My phone is a telephone.
You're like, we're trying to publicize this comic, and you're chopping my limbs off, Jordan.
Anyway, well, yeah, I am on Twitter and also Gmail.
And phone,
is that social media?
The local phone box.
Yeah. And his
get
phone
me
number
your
is.
PO box.
Yeah. No, but this has been awesome, guys. We've loved every moment of it.
Yeah. I'll send you a telegram later, Jordan.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Whoa! What? They just disappeared.
Like that.
Just like that, they're gone.
Honestly, Vince, that's some of the best acting.
Like the music.
You said a minute ago, he's going, I need to get into character. I'm going to do some acting. Yeah. That was brilliant, mate.
Look,
I'm proud.
Look, just like the magicians and illusionists that they write about the in
secrets.
Their work, they've just disappeared. They've just disappeared to go forth and create more great comics. But seriously, folks, we'll say it again, follow them because they're putting out really great work. And you will learn stuff at the same time as sort of having fun reading it. So, yeah.
You only sent us the book through. I'm going to say about 11 o'clock this morning, and I've read half it already.
Oh, brilliant. I'll talk for a couple of chapters. I want to read the rest of it.
It's good.
It's fascinating.
Got to read books in a physical copy. I really struggle with books digitally.
Yeah, I was reading it on my phone, which is a bit shit, but yeah, I know what you mean.
The interesting thing about talking about, like, especially informative and also educational books as well, or semi-autobiographical or things like that, work like that, is discussing them. And you just want to talk about all the great stuff you see or you read and stuff, but we don't want to spoil it for you as well, because the joy is in reading it and discovering these crazy things that have happened in the world, all these people, you know, before a hashtag was a thing.
Yeah, long before fucking Twitter. I actually, because I do quite a lot of research for the other thing, but I actually love it. When you research comic stuff, the time fucking zips by.
Yeah,
there's so many places you can go with it and order stuff off eBay and watch YouTube, you know, interviews with them from 1973. And there's so much out there. It's just great.
Yeah. So to Rick and Jordan, thanks, baby. Right. Put some rank on that.
Hey?
Anyway, never mind. do we have any shout-outs this week, gents?
Yep. Go on, you go first, D.
Two Kickstarters. Mahoney's The Last... And that's running on Kickstarter now. Fantastic comic by our friend Rich, and I've just lost all the fucking details. Rich Carrington, and that's running now. So go check that out. Also, we've got running is Merrick, the Sensational Elephant Man, Volume 2, trade paperback by our friend and first ever guest of the show.
I was thinking about this. Yeah. Tom Ward. I was thinking about this recently. We need to get him back, don't we?
Yeah. Well,
maybe we go for a quickie on the 300th or something like that. Ooh.
Yeah. Like, round it, bookend it. But that's a fantastic one.
It's not the end. It can't be the end bookend.
Yeah.
No.
Or maybe 301, he can be the first of the next 300.
Yes.
New generation.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
ACP, the next generation. So, you can... if you're not sure...
Yeah,
we'll all be wearing Lycra.
If you like, if this comic's for you, you can actually download the first issue for free on the Merrick website. So I recommend you go and check that out and back the first, the Kickstarter for both the first book and the second book, or whichever one you please, both physically and digitally. Go do it. It's made its goal, so you're getting that book. And Luke, Tom even just delivers what all the time.
It's one hell of a combo, that those two, what they've done with that series. I think I'll be pleasing it because I still haven't got a copy of the printed copy of the first trade paperback. So.
No, yeah, I
missed out.
I need that. Yeah, I've put my name down for the first trade, and I'll get the second trade. Hopefully, when we actually see each other in person.
Yeah,
at some point at
one,
some year.
One fine day. Tony, have you got any shouts?
Oh, yeah, I have, yeah. So I got my page through from Gustavo this week. Thank you, Gustavo.
Awesome.
Splashed out. That's an investment. I've been putting that in the safe in the basement. Drink and Draw's coming up, isn't it, soon? It's not long till that now.
Bloody hell, that's coming around, yeah.
First Friday of March. I haven't got the details in front of me, but we'll be sticking that out on the Facebook group and stuff soon, I suspect.
Is that like a week this Friday?
Yeah, it looks that way, isn't it? Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, bloody hell.
It'll be 5th of March.
Okay, right, cool.
Before I've read it, yeah.
Nice one, yeah. Just in relation to my website, I've changed the submission guidelines, so I don't take submissions anymore. I got tired of the same old knucklehead sending me their same old crap. So, to be fair, I think I don't want the UK small press scene to eat its own shit any more than it is. So I shall be searching stuff out, buying it probably, and reviewing it. So no more submissions, folks. Thanks anyway.
I've been buying a rando small press comic per week. And right. The first week it worked out okay. The second 2 weeks were bloody dirge.
Oh, were they? Okay.
Yeah.
I've been going through. There's a lot of Instagram accounts out there. I bought a couple of small press from the States, you know, all over the place. There's a lot of stuff we're missing, guys. I've got to tell you. Because I think we might be stuck in a little bubble. And that's the way I see it. I bought...
Oh, yeah, completely.
Yeah, I bought a comic called Bubblegum Maelstrom this week from a guy called Brian Alves in the States. And it's revelatory.
I'm very much trying to sort of certainly with like Instagram webcomics and like webcomics in general, it's just sort of like,
yeah, you've been putting your foot in that world, haven't you? Yeah, and there's so much more out there as well, you know?
Yeah, pushing beyond I mean, because obviously we've got the creators we love and we'll keep coming back to, but also just pushing on, and because that's part of the show is,
yeah, I don't really want to, if I review issue one, I don't want to then review issue two. You run out of things to say. It's same art writer, same artist. It's not an interesting exercise for me. I want to discover new stuff, and that's what I want to put in your eyeballs. So that's kind of where I'm going with it.
I mean, for instance, a good example of that, and there's a couple of series I've had before, but I'm going to talk about a series on my recommends. Just the way I'm enjoying it, it's going to be the end. I could talk about it on every single time that there's an issue for it, but I'm going to focus on it now and then talk about it.
Fair enough.
Other comics deserve a shout, mate. That's the way I feel about it. Yeah,
totally. Yeah.
And speaking of which, let's shout about some comics, shall we?
Can I do a couple more quick shout outs?
Oh, may we? Of course. Yeah, may we?
A quick shout out to the boys at That Comic Smell. I've got sent through
good lad.
Copy of the anthology.
I will ditto that.
Oh, that's what I should say as well. Tom did an interview with Durf this week. If you haven't heard it, it's really good. There's a real rapport between those two guys. It's not particularly like process. They do touch on it. It's very much like, you know, how you find in life, you know, how do you find the books going, stuff like that. It's really, it's a really relaxed chat. I messaged Tom the other day, say, really good, man. Yeah.
I've got that downloaded. I've yet to listen to it. I'm so behind on a lot of my podcasts.
Yeah.
And I'd want to give a shout out to the drawing contest challenge thing we've got going in the ACP group, which is insert like one of your characters or a comic book character into an older sitcom, TV series, and or film, and see what you come up with. I'm still tinkering with mine, but it's nearly there. So,
still inserting yours, or
yeah, still always inserting it every chance I get.
Good man.
That's up in court next week. So,
what was that? What was that joke I sent you earlier about Red Sonja?
It's probably best not to repeat on there.
Yeah, that was a good one. I don't mind repeating it, but obviously Tony's the.
I made the point that Red Sonja, throughout the Robert E. Howard books, she will only sleep with a man if he bests her in combat. And I say I tried that a few times myself, but I got arrested.
Oh.
That's the way it happens, yeah.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, one thing I pointed last week, I said about my patron thing about, was it last week? Patron thing? And someone, Brian, one of my other patrons, upped his pledge to the top tier.
You got a super level. Somebody's got a super level, haven't they?
Platinum.
Platinum and lace level.
Yeah.
Oh, so, nice. Platinum and lace. Well, what detective duo.
That's a famous strip club in Leicester Square, by the way, which I've never
don't
been
make it
to.
Sorted. This is an all air show, you prick. right.
Go on, you go first, V.
Okay. I briefly touched on it just then. It was a comic. I'll be finding on the weekly releases. There's not too much that's really jumping out to me. at the moment. Certainly, we started up the comic cover reveals it again, but
I fucked up. I didn't do mine.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and this week there was a couple of good ones, but there wasn't too many. But yeah, so. But when there isn't anything on the new Comic Book Wednesday, I thought, let's just have a look and see. I like to, you know, the ones that have just been reduced. Maybe they're an issue one that's a couple of months old or something like that. And I spotted this cover that immediately caught my eye for an Image book called Post-Americana, issue one. And I read it. I immediately got issue two, which had just come out, I think. So... issue one and two is what I'm talking about. And basically, this has gone... I've subscribed to it on Comixology. I tore through this. I immediately got on the WhatsApp to these guys saying, you've got to check this out. It's written, and the writer and art is Steve Skros, if you remember him. I remember him.
Yeah, I like
him
his from, stuff, man. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, he did a lot of... design work and stuff for the Matrix films, but before that, he was always when X-Man first arrived from the Age of Apocalypse, that series. I remember when his style has changed quite a lot since then to be more sort of Jeff Darrow-ish, a little bit of Frank Quitely in there, that kind of stuff. I can see a lot of that. Definitely, I think the influences, because I know Jeff Darrow did a lot of Matrix stuff as well, didn't he? There must have been some sort of bleed through. He is, of course, he's obviously gone on to do. What was the Frankenstein? Was it Doc Frankenstein he did?
Oh, okay. The guys who... That was...
The Wachowskis,
Wachowski sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is written and drawn by him. Colours by Dave Stewart. And the... I don't want to leave out the letters and design. They are someone called Phonographics. But basically, this is... The synopsis is, the Cheyenne Mountain installation, a.k.a. the Bubble, is the most sophisticated super bunker in the world. It was built to ensure the survival of America's executive branch of government and its most important citizens, should the unthinkable happen. When the world ended, the executive branch failed to reach the sanctuary, but the elite citizenry did. 80 years later, one of their own has named himself the new President of the United States. His plan? Subjugate the survivors of the American wasteland using the same bunker resources meant to rebuild it. The only thing standing in their way is a deadly wasteland girl, hell-bent on revenge. I'd probably have to go a bit deeper to do my full trailer voice. It was a time of heroes. You know, that sort of stuff. But this is fucking brilliant. That synopsis, like I say about most synopsis that I read out on this show, doesn't do it justice. The way I sold it to the guys when I messaged them, I said, fucking hell, this is like a Full Moon Studios film that was given like a couple of $100 million budget and a decent director. Because he's fucking crazy. It does start, I mean, because of obviously the political world we live in. And, you know, all of that. The first page immediately opens on the President of the United States speaking. I thought, okay, how's this going to go? Do you know what I mean? Is this going to be very heavily American sort of political sort of book? But then it opens up into it. It's a post-apocalyptic wasteland story with a lot of the haves and the have-nots. And there's a rebellion. You've got your classic sort of story tropes in there. Rebellions, people trying to take them out. Before it does jump quite quickly into the wasteland itself. And there are cannibals. The main character themselves. There's a great reveal in the second issue, which is a total sort of jaw drop moment of a bit more of a story about this character. And it's kick-ass. Like, there's so much detail on every page. There is gore in abundance. There's mutant chickens. Giant mutant chickens that attack people and kill them. There's heads being blown off. There is a strange cannibal cult where one of them looks like he's walked straight in off Doll Man. That's why I say it would be right over your
like
street, isn't it?
Yeah, like that.
You know when like those when they did the post-apocalyptic ones and one of the characters clearly had more makeup work done on them because they looked like a little bit... Their head was misshapen and they had body armour and things like that. It's that kind of stuff. But also, good props to Scrooge's writing skills as well, because this is genuinely funny as well. I mean, it's dark in places. It goes OTT and properly full in, you know, properly into it. But just there's just little bits of dialogue sometimes that makes me laugh. For instance, a one speech bubble, two main characters are talking, and the main heroine says, I knew some good people too, pal. They got blown to pieces by your little community. Know this, I'm going to kill every motherfucker in that place. I shit thee nay. And that last line made me laugh out loud.
I bet you're saying that now. I bet you're going to make that a catchphrase, aren't you? I know you like it.
Shit thee nay.
Shit thee nay.
Yep. And like, and then immediately, there's just great like dialogue soon afterwards. The woman says, you don't know me, chump. Epic overconfidence is what butters my bread. And I'm like, fucking hell.
I'll butter her bread.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
That's
we'll
like
see.
A party trick. I swallow a bit of string and it comes out tied together. Oh, shit you not.
Every week. Every
that
week.
That is class. That is class. And so is this book. There's great sort of... I mean, the first issue ends on an epic spread of cannibals. You know, when they have the reveal of the cannibals, and one of them looks like... He looks like he's wearing a Hawaiian shirt, and he's got like a little sort of... But then you when you look at the shirt, the shirt is made of faces.
I feel like cannibals aren't as much of a taboo as they used to be.
No.
Now
Hollywood stars are doing it, aren't they?
Cannibals.
Yeah, who's that bloke who was in The Lone Ranger? Isn't he into it now? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he said about saying about it, yeah.
Allegedly.
Army Hammer.
That's him, yeah. Allegedly.
Yeah, son of MC.
Yeah.
But seriously, folks, I think a lot of the people that listen to this show, and if you laugh at some of the nonsense we talk about, you will get a real kick out of this. It's got real energy to it. And the story's going somewhere as well. I can't... It's the top of my to-read pile now, post-Americana. I absolutely love it. And I, like I say, I subscribed. I think it's a six-issue series as well. And there's some interesting things coming up, including like some definite homages to some superhero comics of some kind.
Oh.
It's going to be interesting, you know. So, certain Frank Miller... There's a sort of page at some point where there's a Frank Miller homage and a clear sort of Dark Knight style thing, which is going in some sort of direction. So,
okay.
But definitely,
I was watching an interview about Dark Knight 3 earlier. They lost their minds on that, didn't they?
Why?
I'd never read that one. I just, after that second one, I just felt like I'd been punched in the face.
Mm.
I just didn't like it at all.
I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. It's just stay off the Charlie, guys. Do you know what I mean? It's like, other drugs are available, and it's allegedly not the drug they were taking. Thank you.
Speaking of things to get addicted to, who wants to go next for their comic?
D-Man, do you want to go?
Yeah, Tony spoke about this wonderful comic last week, and my printed edition turned up on Thursday or Friday, and it's Puno, Altiplano Volume 2 by Gustavo Vargas, and it's an absolute fucking joy. It's lovely. I kind of was quite late to the party with Gustavo's work, and I picked up a lot of them last year at Thought Bubble, and just it's fucking just great. It's so good. I mean, this is when you get the advice about sort of writing a story and telling the story only you can tell. This is that personified.
Yeah, isn't it?
That's a good Gustavo point. Vargas, like, he's mixed. The story comes from him and what he's interested in, and no one else could do it the way he's done it. And I feel like everyone's got that story in them. You just need to kind of identify that and tap into it.
But I tell you what, I see a bit of Steve Scrooge in his work as well, guys.
I'd agree.
It's that quality to it, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
And Tony mentioned the double page spreads, and you really got to see them to do them justice. It's fucking great. I can't really talk about the story because it's relative. It's quite. You need to kind of know where it's coming from, and I don't want to give you some ham-fisted review of the story or try and walk you through it. I can only suggest that you buy it and read it for yourself, because it's a joy. Yeah, I absolutely love the comic. As soon as it came through, I was like, that's fucking going right to the top of the pile, and I got stuck into it.
Good stuff.
And I got stickers and an A5 print of it, so I was very happy.
Look at
you. Yeah, me too. I got that as well. Yeah. Yeah. Real nice one.
You'll have a nice package, don't you, Dan?
Yeah. Here we go. Here we go. Yeah.
We talk about cocks.
9 points. And balls.
Cock and balls.
Yeah. Never forget the taint.
I was watching that that chap with Ramesh and the other bloke. Oh, he was talking about fucking drag stuff. And they were talking about popping their testicles back up inside them.
I don't even know how that works.
Yeah. How does that work? I literally do not want to know how that works.
I mean, saying that, Dan, were you putting your comic back in its comic bag, or were you actually attempting to do what you're talking about as we're speaking?
Oh, no, I was putting Puno back in the bag that it came in.
Is that what you're calling it? Right, okay, right,
So if you tried that, write in.
Let
us know.
Yeah. And if you're one of those two comedians, please stop making programs because you're on my television all the time and it's annoying me.
Well, that's not hard, Tony. Why do you watch TV anyway? You should be reading comics, such as
Saturday night. I used to be watching Ant and Dec. Now I'm watching fucking two blokes push their genitals up inside themselves.
Hang on, isn't that the same thing?
Is that the same thing?
From a pair of cocks?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, PJ and Duncan have let themselves go. What are they doing now?
Get ready to rumble.
Let's get ready to rumble. Pop. Right. Where were we, Tony?
Yeah, I spent so much of the day sitting around today that my arse hurt, and that's a real first world problem.
You were made to say that on the internet.
Yes. James said to say that. I've got no shame in saying that.
What were you sat on?
Daniel's arse.
My arse.
No, that's not what I meant. Obviously, I mean, what else are you going to sit
on? I've got a seat, like a sofa bed out in the garage area, and I was just sitting there and. It's shit, basically. It's a shit bed and there's a shit sofa.
Were you just sat in the garage by yourself?
Wanking.
No, it's reading.
Watching out.
Oh, reading. I'm just going to go out to the garage and read.
Read.
Please knock on the door if you come out.
Yeah.
Why are so many tissues involved in reading?
Why is the door locked? Reasons.
Yeah. It's a very intense reading experience.
And it. Anyway, enough about me masturbating in the garage.
Well, there is a link. This the comic I'm going to review is called Casual Fling, and it's by AWA Upshot, who very kindly send us review copies on occasion. It's written by Jason Starr, and Jason Starr is the reason I picked it up. Have you guys heard of him before?
I feel like I have.
He's written a few comics. He did some Wolverine. He did something with the Vertigo True Crime series, but he's mostly known as a thriller writer. And I read, he did quite a few books in that Hard Case Crime series. Do you remember those novels that came out? They were sort of pulpy recreations, and you know, there's quite a lot of comics writers involved in it. And he did some stuff with Ken Brune, who's also a very interesting hardboiled fiction, pulpy, noir-y kind of guy. So I bought it because of him, because I really like his stuff. And then I realized the art is by Dalibor Talagic. Do you know what Dalibor Talagic has also drawn?
No.
That special issue, it wasn't particularly well written, but it was well drawn, of Master of Kung Fu issue 126, which came out about, I don't know, about 9 years ago, something like that. And I own a page from that. So I've always been a fan of his writing, his art, sorry. Colours by Marco Lesko. Steve Wands did the letters, and a cover is by Dan. I'm going to say the cover is a little bit underwhelming, to be honest. It's just... they're trying to be a bit too clever, and in doing that, it doesn't make it very eye-catching. It does tell a story once you concentrate and look on it, but it's not one that would show up immediately on a, you know, look at that on the shelf. It's like not one of those. Do you know what I mean? If you look at it under Comixology, it describes it as mystery and the superhero genre, which did get me thinking a little bit about it, and I'll explain why in a minute. So Jennifer Ryan is its main character. From the outside, it looks like her life is perfect. She works in a high-performing, sort of high-pressure lawyer firm in Manhattan, and her husband is a stay-at-home dad and looks after the two kids. But their cracks are really beginning to show in their relationship because of that. I mean, it's not anymore, but at a certain point, you know, in Western history, it was considered to be a reversal of roles, wasn't it, I suppose? And he's kind of a bit overwhelmed with working from home, and he's getting crabby with her, and she's in this high-powered, you know, suits and in this big business. And he's always complaining to her. And Jason Starr spends a lot of time showing a real relationship, which I thought was really good. But a relationship that is on the rocks. They clearly have, you know, have loved each other. They've got two kids. They've got a nice home, but they're ghosts in the presence of each other almost. So, you know, there's no real spark going on. She's really feeling the pressure at work as well. And she's trying to balance that work, you know, being at work all the time and also getting home in time for stuff like the ballet recital for the kids and stuff like that. Whilst out, she shouldn't have gone out really to the pub, but she sort of gave in from pressure from colleagues. And rather than going home, she goes out for a drink with one of her colleagues, and she ends up meeting a guy called called Alex Miles. They immediately hit off, and she's left in the bar with him, and they begin to flirt, and their hands, you know, their hands brush each other, and she puts her foot on his leg, and there's something really going on. And the conversation is very natural, and at first you don't suspect that it's being bent to either their wills, but there's a certain element where they play on the life that she could have lived. You know, she talks about traveling to Europe, which obviously she doesn't get to do now. She talks about a number of things, which obviously she doesn't get to do now. You think something's going to happen. It's very clever the way he writes it. You think something's going to happen, and it doesn't. And she comes to her senses and disappears off to her piano, to her kids' ballet recital, which she misses. But whilst the next few days she can't stop thinking about him, and the art plays on that. It does little flashbacks to his smile and their hands touching and stuff like that. And even though she's running away through her normal life, and then a chance encounter it probably isn't a chance encounter, because he's a businessman in town who's going to be about for a few days before returning home. But they have a chance encounter in a coffee shop. And she said, oh, how strange. It's just around the corner from where I work. And he says, oh, that's really weird. I'm just in here getting a coffee. My flat's nearby, or my hotel's nearby, you know. And that leads to them sleeping together. So she ends up back at his hotel room, or his hotel suite. And he has a moment where he says he's got a single kink, and it's wearing a mask, and he's got a golden mask, a bit like the masks they wore in that Kubrick movie. Was it Eyes Wide Shut? Do you know the one I mean? Slightly sort of psychosexual. And she sleeps with him. She gets up before the evening is properly over and leaves. And he's saying, you know, do you have to go? And she's going, I have to go. And this kind of has a positive effect on her in a strange sort of way. It's kind of put her right about her priorities in life. And she does spend a lot of time now. She's almost motivated by the guilt of the incident, I kind of sense. And she's putting more effort into being at home and suggesting to her husband that they have a date night and stuff like that. And then she gets a phone call from him, and from a withheld number, and it turns out to be this Alex again. And at that point, on the very last page, you realise, oh, right, something's happened. Now, the fact that it's described as a mystery and a superhero comic got me wondering, because there's no real superhero element in the start of it, but I'm wondering if there's something that leads into issue two. It's a four-issue miniseries. Because Jason Starr's a thriller, hardball noir writer, it's written in that way. You know, the whole noir thing where nobody is perhaps perfect, you know, and, you know, that sort of thing. And he does spend a lot of time building character and that soft burn of the relationship that, you know, that finally ends in sex. And then her, as far as she's concerned, ends. And she's a really well-written, Jennifer's a really well-written, solid character. Did I think they took too long in revealing it? Possibly. I think that will be dependent on what the second issue's like. Is the first issue a long setup, a preamble? Well, kind of possibly, yeah. Could it have been told a little bit quicker? Maybe. I don't know. I think I'm going to hold my breath on that until I see the second issue. I'm certainly going to read the second issue, so I suppose it does do the right thing. It does tick the boxes in order to get me to buy the second thing. But I suspect that the spiral downwards now begins, and that she'll be pulled into sort of more crimes, or maybe a murder, or the superhero element might appear. I'm just sort of guessing, but the art is really solid. It's a little bit more cartoony than I'm used to with his work, but I do find Talagic very readable. It's slightly looser than the Master of Kung Fu stuff. AWA doing some interesting stuff, and it's not all superheroes, and it's not all what you'd expect. There's a little bit of horror element, there's a little bit of thriller element, and this is something different altogether. I think they're putting their money where their mouths are around a lot of their comics. Because this has two variant covers. We've got one by Mark Diodato Jr. and one by Lee Loughridge. So they are clearly like putting it out there and getting like, this is going to happen. This is, we really want this to happen. And I think that's good. They did, was it American Ronin that we looked at?
Yeah.
a few weeks ago. We all looked it online, didn't we? You can find them at AWA Studios, AWA underscore studios, and at Upshot underscore studios, Upshot being their more adult line. If you go to awastudios.net, you can read a lot of their first issues for free and stuff like that, which we've talked about before as being a good little in and out. Seems to be something that a lot of people are doing. Yeah, I recommend it. And I also recommend a lot of Jason Starr's books. If you fancy like a nice, you know, 220-page noir book, then he's definitely the bloke to go to. And then the book, he did a series of three books with Ken Broome, which are really good as well. I think that's my one for this week.
Nice.
Hey, nice one. See? Yeah.
So once again, another week full of amazing recommendations and comics and all kinds of just comic-filled paraphernalia. Cool, that was a big word to use at the end of the show, wasn't it?
It's been a packed show.
It has
been a packed show.
Like we said, go forth and get the books from Rick and Jordan, and thank you to them for joining us again. And thank you to you all for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed it this week on the run into 300.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. But if there's anything we discussed on this week's show, or anything you want us to discuss in the next coming weeks, there's several ways you can get in touch with us. You can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @theawesomepod, where we'll be talking, well, retweeting cool comic stuff, talking about future guests, etc., and all that. And the other guys have got the keys to the car on that one as well, so who knows what you'll get. But if you do the Book of Faces, go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast and join the community group on Facebook, Awesome Comics Talk. If you're one of those, I don't do Facebook, it's really the only reason you need to do Facebook, because there's a wonderful community of people on there.
There are quite a few people who've just signed up for Facebook to be on there.
Yeah.
Which I kind of find quite gratifying.
Yeah. Because you just want to talk to like-minded people just about comics without being no hard selling, no... None of that.
We have discussed about setting a forum up elsewhere, but it is like, I don't know if we're equipped to kind of do it or
manage it or something.
And whether the migration of all the people who are currently on there at the moment will follow it, because you're all awesome, the people that are on there. So keep it up. And thank you all for listening to us, whether it was on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe and leave a review. It helps get the word out about the show and all of the great books, creators and more that we talk about on a weekly basis. If you listen to us on any of the other networks, such as Spotify, Amazon, Stitcher, Podnose, Podknife, what other networks are we on, Tony?
Well, with it being lockdown, I've been watching stuff like Homes Under the Hammer. Have you guys been watching that sort of thing?
I've not, no. Not
for a long time. Are you depressed?
Or maybe Holiday Homes or stuff like that.
Do you need to talk, Tony? Are you a little...
Perennially depressed. So I've been listening to a podcast and it's called Sarah Jessica Parker's Back Door. And it's a similar sort of podcast.
Fuck, why did I try drinking? Why did I... dear, is it a good show?
Yeah, it really gets into it, yeah.
Does it?
Yeah.
How deep does it get in? Right, no.
Well, they open the door to you, fully open the door to you. It's really good. Yeah.
Much like we do on a weekly basis. So thank you for listening, everyone. Where can people find us online, etc.? Tony?
NeverIronAnything.com. There you go.
There you go. Dan?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at VanguardComic.com. I still got a Parler account. I haven't used it.
Why?
Well, just... back.
Yeah, I still have.
Yeah. But still.
Oh, and another thing. I just got a lovely email from Matt Strott. So Strott, he says hello, guys.
Hey, hello, Matt. Hello, Matt.
I really miss his presence. I was thinking about how I could reach out to him. I think I've got Matt's email. So
yeah, I emailed him.
Yeah. How you doing?
Yes. And we hope you're all doing well. You can follow me on social media at Jester Diablo, where... It'll just be me waffling about something, or about the show, or about things I like, because that's what we need to talk more about: good things that we like, and get other people to read good comics. So, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Wherever you are, we hope you're okay, doing well, healthy, because we all love you, don't we?
Pretty much, really? Yeah.
No.
Ah,
Tony, we will make you love.
You can't force me to love you.
I'll force you to love someone.
That's why you're up in court, Tony. I don't know why
you can't get this. Taking Red Sonja is a good example.
Oh, dear God.
Dear God.
Before this man, becomes
a man wrote that about Red Sonja, you know, a little inkling.
Robert E. Howard was a bit weird. He lived with his mum and killed himself in his 40s. So I can't imagine he was normal, was he?
No. That's not the way to live.
No.
But thank you for listening, everyone. Go forth, read loads of comics. And from Dan, Tony and myself, just have a good week. Meet us back here next week where we'll be talking with some more great people. And until then, what do they do, guys?
Stay awesome.
Stay awesome.
Fucking brilliant.
I tell you what, you the delivery was clean from both of you. You just need to get the timing right, but we'll get there. We'll get there.
That was fucking gold.
That was gold. What are you talking about, Vince?
Fucking hell, your time.
No debris on us.
Jesus Christ. You must be late for every train that you need to catch, Dan.
I'm going to make a reference 90% of our audience won't get. You know, fucking Dad's Army, the geezer who comes in late, Jones.
Yeah. Are you Jones? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I think you're the cabin boy in what's that fucking cartoon? E-Jack, you're late.
Captain Pugwash.
Captain Pugwash. The cabin boy was always late, wasn't he?
God.
E-Jack, you're late. So say that again. Ejaculate.
Sorry, I've just literally
I've got it.
I'm tired. My arse hurts.
Yes.
Dan's... My arse hurts.
Don't get around that. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
When people listen tomorrow, it'll be seamless. It'll be smooth.
Yeah.
No one will have any idea.
They'll get it in the edit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be like a porn star's private. Totally smooth.
What?
I was bemoaning the fact there's no Bush anymore earlier. I was chatting about that.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Get it one out of your system now, Tony.
Who was he talking to, by the way? Wasn't Dan like the calf?
It was just myself. It was the dog. Just chatting to the dog about it. There's no one else to talk to about bushes anymore, is there?
Yeah, just screaming in the street to anyone who'd listen.
Yeah. What's the state of pubic hair? Leave me alone.
Oh, God. And we haven't even started properly yet.
I don't know where my chest hair begins and my pubic hair begins. It just all flows into one.
It's hard to say, isn't it? Like, where is the line?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Just looks like a Jack Russell with its tongue out.